What great spirit out there. Take a deep breath together. So welcome, everyone. Thank you all for coming to our keynote address for Earth Week 2010 at University of Vermont here in Burlington, Vermont. My name is Stephanie Kaza, and I'm the director of the UVM Environmental Program, host to almost 500 majors and minors in environmental studies. Tonight we are celebrating Earth Week in the midst of a stunning early spring with crabapples, forsythia, magnolias, azaleas, and daffodils in bloom on every city block. Boaters are out on Lake Champlain, bikers and runners fill the path, and the green mountains are beginning to glow with the first green shimmer of spring leaf out. So tonight it is my great honor and pleasure to welcome two nationally and internationally known 21st century visionaries, John Todd and Derek Jensen. Dr. John Todd is a leading pioneer in the field of ecological design and engineering, the winner of the 2008 Buckminster Fuller Challenge, and the author of From Eco-Cities to Living Machines, Principles of Ecological Design. And Derek Jensen is the acclaimed author of Endgame, A Language Older Than Words, The Culture of Make-Believe, and among other books. Writer, teacher, activist, and voice of uncompromising dissent, he is well known to environmental audiences around the country and will be heading from here to Oberlin College tomorrow night. We'll hear more about each of these guests from their introducers in just a moment. So it is our good fortune to be able to hear from these two impassioned and committed environmentalists this week in celebration of the 40th anniversary of Earth Day. Events like this take tremendous planning and coordination, so I would just like to begin by thanking our lead sponsor, the UVM Environmental Program, and all the co-sponsors, UVM Garden Club, Students for Peace and Global Justice, VSTEP, the Vermont Student Environmental Program, and UVM Student Life. We're also grateful to UVM Conference and Event Services for technical hosting and setup here in Ira Allen, and to the media recording the event, Free Vermont Radio, Channel 17, CCTV, Vermont Commons. And also a fabulous network of student volunteers have handled everything from publicity to security to book selling. Coordinated, I would especially like to highlight by the lead organizers, Keith Brunner and Debbie Krug. And their efforts were supported every step of the way by Erin Haney, Environmental Program Administrative Staff and Master Detail Manager. So please join me sharing our appreciation for all who have contributed to making this event a success. So our program tonight will begin with some reflections on this 40th anniversary of Earth Day by John Todd, with an introduction by Samir Doshi. Then Keith Brunner will introduce our keynote speaker, and we'll then hear from Derek Jensen. If there's time, we'll host a short question and answer session. We'll see how long the talk goes. We're expecting about an hour, but you know, there's a lot of energy here, so let's see what happens. Last but not least, please turn off your cell phones for the evening. And this is an invitation to give your full attention to our speakers, as well as this wonderful chance to be with each other in spirited community. So thank you all very much for coming to this event. May it galvanize us all to reconsider our relationship with this beautiful planet we call home. And now, Samir.
Thank you very much, Stephanie. Wow, this is a real treat to see this place full. It is my honor and true pleasure to introduce Dr. John Todd, along with his wife, Nancy Jack Todd. John has crafted a legacy for over four decades that's influenced most aspects of the environmental movement, both directly and indirectly. The two of them founded the New Alchemy Institute, in the 70s, Ocean Arcs International in the 80s, and also pioneered several exciting technologies for really allowing us to understand how we can live better in our community, in our place. There's also several awards, the EPA Environmental Merit Award. Stephanie listed a couple of others and, you know, another couple dozen or so you can add to the list. The aspect that I find most endearing and inspiring from both Nancy and John is not only their commitment to their craft and work, but the fact that they enjoy life more than any other two people that I really know. It's fantastic to see. Please join me in welcoming John Todd.
Good evening, everybody. It's really wonderful to be here tonight. It's also a great honor and privilege to be the warm-up act for Derek Jensen. And I'm looking forward to hearing him. In the beginning, 40 years ago, was the first Earth Day. We were living in San Diego. 9 months earlier, we'd created a little institute, Nancy and I, with our great friend Bill McLarney, called the New Alchemy Institute, with the audacious motto to restore the lands, protect the seas, and inform the Earth's stewards. And because of that, I was invited to speak at the first Earth Day celebration in Southern California. And I walked into this huge stadium filled with people, and I kid you not, my warm-up band was Santana. And I gave my talk when I railed against the pollution industrial government complex, or PIG, and then invited people to join with me to try and find a way of living that truly honored the Earth and our fellow beings. And after it was over, my talk was followed by, at the time, not a very well-known band known as the Grateful Dead. So it was launched in fine style. So at the beginning, there was a wake-up call. That's really what launched it. The ospreys were disappearing, the pelicans, their shells were so thin, the babies were not being born. Everywhere we looked, the world was in disarray, and the chemicals we were creating seemed to be destroying the fabric of life. So the idea then was to get on with saving the world. I suppose I should add now, saving ourselves as well, and to really begin to redesign how we lived. So we did have our instructions then. Our manifesto was a great prose poem by the poet Gary Snyder called Four Changes, and you should read it. It's as relevant tonight as it was then. And I'm going to read you just three short sentences from this poem to give you a flavor of the time. It's under the subject transformation. We have it within our deepest powers not only to change ourselves but to change our culture. If we are to survive on Earth, we must transform the fine five-millennia-long urbanizing civilization tradition into a new ecologically sensitive, harmony-oriented, wild-minded, scientific, spiritual culture. Wow. It was right there. Goal. Nothing short of total transformation will do much good. What we envision is a planet on which the human population lives harmoniously and dynamically by employing a sophisticated and unobtrusive technology in a world environment which is left natural. And then it ends. And everybody was reading it, I might add. We are the first human beings in history to have all of humanity's culture and previous experience available to our study. The first members of a civilized society since the early Neolithic to wish to look clearly into the eyes of the wild and see our selfhood, our family there. We have these advantages to get off the obvious disadvantages of being as screwed up as we are, which gives us a fair chance to penetrate into some of the riddles of ourselves and the universe. Our instructions. Our operation manual at the time was the Whole Earth Catalog, where Stuart Brand and his colleagues were reorganizing human knowledge at the time around the teachings of Gregory Bateson and Buckminster Fuller and others, the great whole systems thinkers who felt that we had to relearn how to think. And the Whole Earth Catalog did an excellent job of starting that process. And also, I think our way of life was clear. Life was to be a spiritual journey, a rediscovery of the old ways, of the traditions, from the East, Taoism, Buddhism, from this continent, from the native peoples, and so on. And we knew we just couldn't graft those traditions without bringing to it the idea of a sacred ecology, which was growing out of those traditions and the emerging science of ecology itself. What was interesting then is after the first Earth Day began a process that continues to today, the birth of new, sometimes radical, sometimes very radical organizations. Out of Northern California, Sim van der Rijn and others established the Farallone Institute. We established the New Alchemy Institute and then moved it to Cape Cod in Massachusetts in 1970. Further in the Rockies, Amory and Hunter Lovins created the Rocky Mountain Institute. And down in Arkansas, Wes and Dana Jackson created the Land Institute to search for a perennial agriculture. Down in Fox, Arkansas, David Orr and his brother Will created the Meadow Creek Project to do the same thing. And then across the ocean in England, there was Brad, there was the Quarry, there was Fritz Schumacher, the great economist organization, the Intermediate Technology Group. And then over in France, there was Michel Moustin and Jean-Paul Rogier, who left they were called 68ards, the radicals of 68, and they went to the south of France and created their own institution, and so on in Germany and beyond. And all of those groups began to communicate with each other through kind of tribal gatherings and through getting international agencies to pay us to meet in places like Paris. And then there were other kinds of organizations like urban organization, including the Institute for Local Self-Reliance in Washington. I should have mentioned them earlier. And then the cultural historian William Irwin Thompson creates the Lindisfarne Association, and so on. It became very quickly a global movement. And since that time, that process is accelerating. Every one of those original organizations started spinning off new organizations. And so it's really grown exponentially. Little NGOs active all over the world doing really important, interesting things. Really quite a story. And the threads have been kept intact. More recently, here in Vermont, the organization 350.org, both local and global at the same time, setting a precedence for staring straight into the eye of the urgency of climate change. And other organizations are growing here in this town and everywhere, almost on a daily basis. And by the late 1990s, even companies were forming that had normally been considered antithetic to this movement with social visions and social commitments. And now we have a number of these, including the Ecological Investment Company of Vermont, that set out to work towards a future in a using the business model as the engines for their financial and structural organization. So over the past decades, what's gone wrong? Well, I'm not going to spend much time here because people in this room know more about it probably than I do. But by every measure, things have gotten worse. This tribe I'm talking to you about has not changed the basic paradigm or the thrust of civilizations yet. Whether you're talking about forest or soils or pollution or population, we're scared to talk about population. None of these issues have been really well addressed. And so we find ourselves here in 2010 facing a world even more vulnerable than what it was when we started. In fact, by some measures, more of the world's resources have been consumed since the first Earth Day than in all the history of humanity before that. Terrifying. So what went right? Something's got to have gone right. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. I think I'd be on some beach somewhere. Well, I won't go into what I would be doing on that beach. But one of the great things that's happened, and there's a lot of it going on here, is the discovery or the rediscovery of nature's operating instructions. A lot of us have been looking into the 3 billion year legacy of life itself and asking the questions, Forrest, what is it that you know that we need to know to design our societies? Coral reef, how is it that you manage this exquisite ecology with so few resources beyond sunlight, and so on. And it's been a marvelous to see how this flowering of knowledge has taken place. And under that, under its sort of guidance, has emerged the ecological design as a discipline. With ecological design, we are now learning how to integrate what we do with the natural world to the mutual benefit of both. How to do an awful lot with very little through understanding nature's operating instructions. We can generate foods. We can grow fuels. We can clean up environments. We can create buildings. We can create communities. And we are beginning that, in fact, mirror the deepest, most profound workings of the natural world. We can create a culture through ecological design that, in fact, is highly adapted to the world that is informationally rich and resource poor. And that's the era that we're entering. Right now, as never before, the stakes couldn't be higher. A lot of us are being lulled into thinking that simply by buying green, we can save the world. But it goes far beyond that, as D. Derek will let us know. What we have to do, for example, maybe one of our greatest challenge is to stabilize climate. A number of us think that to stabilize climate, we have to put the carbon dioxide atmosphere from the atmosphere into new soils. To some of us, the creation of soils on a global scale with the knowledges of ancient people and modern techniques is perhaps the greatest challenge and the one opportunity to stabilize the climate. But if we created 1,000 years of topsoil or its equivalent in a few decades, the benefits, just think about it, around the world would be enormous. Clean water, food, healthy ecosystems, it all starts with soil. And a number of people here are working on the very techniques that can make this miracle happen. And there are people working all over the world on these techniques. And taken together, our ability to be true earth stewards is possible. I'm making the point here today that we now have the tools, and that's the legacy of the last four decades, to move into the future. We did not have them on that Earth Day when the Grateful Dead played so well. But ultimately, it's a spiritual journey. And that's what it must be. The discovery of who we are in relation to the Earth and our fellow creatures. Anything that takes us away from that diminishes our life. Anything that brings us closer to that expands our horizons. And I'm going to, this whole attitude is expressed beautifully by Tolkien when he has Gandalf say, "The rule of no realm is mine, but all worthy things that are in peril, as the world now stands, those are my care. As for my part, I shall not wholly fail in my task if anything passes through this night that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again in days to come. For I too am a steward. Did you not know?" Thank you.
Thank you so much, John, and for all the work that you have done over the years. We're so lucky tonight to get to have him as a member of our community speaking to us. Now, Keith will introduce Derek Jensen, our featured speaker of the evening.
Thank you, Dr. Todd. Thanks, Stephanie, Samir. So I've been thinking a lot about culture and the role of culture in a movement, thinking about art, thinking about music, and thinking about theater. And I came across a quote from Augusto Boal, who is the Brazilian pioneer that asked us to redefine the art of theater. And he wrote this in the introduction to one of his books. "Why should we, in this war, be mere spectators who cannot decide about the actions to be taken, but who would certainly pay for the consequences of those actions? People feel that they should intervene, go onto the stage where the action is being undertaken. But where is the stage? And how is it to be occupied? Indeed, to become politically involved is to shift one's self-perception from that of a spectator to one of an actor in this ongoing drama that is the state of the world in 2010. And to become an actor, one must know the stage that they are acting upon. To our huge detriment, most environmentalist, climate activist, and social justice discourse either minimizes or through its absence utterly disregards this crucial element that we might call historical context. It's the stage. Derek Jensen's writing starts with this stage and builds from there. Cited in 2008 by the Utni Reader magazine as one of 50 readers who are changing your world, Jensen's work is underpinned by a searing and original critique of the culture of Western civilization. His 2002 book, The Culture of Make-Believe, was cited by the J. Anthony Lucas Book Prize panel as a passionate and provocative meditation on the nexus of racism, genocide, environmental destruction, and corporate malfeasance, where civilization meets its discontents. Jensen's work spans traditional academic fields. He has made startling connections between violence, domestic abuse, and this culture's twisted relationship with the living planet. He has written exposés on topics ranging from science and technology, human waste in the culture of civilization, and the global and intensifying assault on forests. With the publication of his 2006 piece, Endgame, he took this critique and turned it into a call to action. Do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? If not, how does this shift our strategies and tactics? Armed with this question, Derek's work has increasingly been focused around the conception of resistance. His provocative columns in the magazine Orion have ranged from criticizing consumer-led social change to deconstructing our conception and reliance upon hope as a social force. However, at the very heart of Derek Jensen's writing lies a deep passion, a love for both the natural world and for humanity. As he states, if we wish to stop the atrocities, we need merely to step away from the isolation. There is a whole world waiting for us, ready to welcome us home. It is this call to reconnect, to rebuild our relationships with each other and the ecosystems of which we are a part, that is providing the seed for the next generation of engaged activists. I'm thrilled to welcome Derek Jensen to Burlington, Vermont, and let's please give him a great round of applause.
Can you hear me in the back? Okay, great. Thank you so much. Where'd you go? For that wonderful introduction. I think that might be like the best introduction ever. You know, I've heard my talks once or twice before, and it actually makes me want to hear it. God, this sounds really interesting. So I would like to thank all of you for showing up. It makes me really happy that you're here. And also, it makes very clear what an extraordinary job of marketing, as she put it, that Debbie and Keith and Aaron and Carla have done. I'm sorry. And Ben and Stephanie and, yeah, so them too also. Before we start, I would like to thank the Center for Media and Democracy, Free Vermont Radio, UVM Environmental Program, UVM Garden Club, Students for Peace and Global Justice, VSTEP, UVM Student Life, the people I already mentioned, Keith, Debbie, we can mention them again, Keith, Debbie, Aaron, Carla, Ben. I would like to also thank Stephanie, wherever she went, and Samir, and also, I'm very honored to be sharing the stage with John Todd. I am. It's a deep honor to share the stage with one of this movement's elders and all around important people. So thank you. So what I would like to talk about tonight is I would like to talk about my book, Endgame. I've been doing this talk for a while, and I keep wanting to talk about some other things, but I think that the material in it is important enough that we need to keep really covering it. It's like I just finished writing a book about 3 weeks ago that's about our relationship to dreams and to muses, and I would love to talk about that, but at the same time, 120 species went extinct today, and 120 species are going to go extinct tomorrow and the day after. And I don't think there's anything more important to talk about than sort of the foundations of this culture's destructiveness. And where I would like to start this talk, actually, is by opening my water without spilling it all over my pants. There we go. Yeah, thank you very much. This is a performance art piece about the relationship between you. So thank you very much. Good night. So I don't know if you know this, but the movie Star Wars was not actually written by George Lucas and company. The movie Star Wars was, as the original draft, the first draft of the movie, was written by environmentalists. And it was quite a bit different than the way the movie ended up on screen. And is there anybody in here who does not know the plot of Star Wars? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's always the same. It's always like one or two people going. It's like coming out of the closet or something. Come on. How many don't know the plot of Star Wars? Come on, for real. See, there we go. Okay, so Star Wars came out in about 1977, which was the perfect year for it to come out for me because I was in high school, and I went to see it, and then I went back and I told my friends, oh my God, you have to see this movie. The acting is so good. And then my friends all went to see it too. You know, we weren't those nerds who went to see it 1,000 times or anything. For one thing, we weren't nerds. And for another thing, we were all way too busy playing Dungeons and Dragons. But the plot of the movie Star Wars, for those of you who don't know it, is that the Empire has built this giant machine that is capable of destroying entire planets. It's called the Death Star. And that's a wonderful metaphor for the dominant culture, which is a giant machine that's killing the planet. And in the movie, the rebels figure out how to blow up the Death Star. And so in the exciting final scene, Luke Skywalker uses the Force to get past all the TIE fighters and to drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port. Well, okay, so I was kind of a nerd. Anyway, so to drop a torpedo down a thermal exhaust port and blow up the Death Star. And I've now just ruined the entire movie for you. But it's still worth seeing for the acting. And anyway, so the environmentalist version was a little bit different than that. For one thing, it wasn't actually called Star Wars. It was called Star Nonviolent Civil Disobedience. And for another thing, they didn't actually blow up the Death Star. Instead, they set up programs. They used other tactics to slow the intergalactic march of empire. For example, they set up programs for people on planets about to be destroyed to produce luxury items like hemp hacky sacks and gourmet coffee for sale to inhabitants of the Death Star. Audience members will also discover there are plans afoot to encourage loads of troopers and other citizens of the Empire to take eco-tours of doomed planets. Their purpose will be to show to one and all that these planets are economically important to the Empire and so should not be destroyed. In a surprise move that would get viewers to the edge of their seats, other groups of rebels file lawsuits against the Empire, attempting to show that the environmental impact statement that Darth Vader is required to file failed to adequately support his decision that blowing up the planet would cause no significant impact. Viewers will thrill to learn of plans to boycott items produced by corporations that have Darth Vader on the board of directors. And they will leap to their feet in theaters worldwide when they see bags full of letters written directly to Mr. Vader himself, asking that he please not blow up any more planets. Scribbled in the margins, a note from one of the screenwriters. For accuracy's sake, when we show examples of these letters, it is imperative that all letters to Mr. Vader be respectful and courteous, but they stress the need to find cooperative solutions to the differences between the rebels and the Empire. Under no circumstances should the letters be such that they would alienate or anger Mr. Vader. If the letters upset Mr. Vader, the rebels' letter campaign to the Grand Moff Tarkin will certainly fail as well. Now, we all know that that would be sufficient not only to bring the Empire to its knees, but to make a damn fine, exciting movie. The thing is, there's more. Thousands of renegade rebels, unhappy with what they perceive as toadying on the part of the mainstream rebels, decide, in a scene guaranteed to bring tears to the eyes of even the most cold-hearted theatergoers, to stand on the planets about to be destroyed link arms, and sing Give Peace a Chance. They send DVDs of that to Darth Vader and his boss, the Grand Moff Tarkin, to whom they also send wave after wave of loving kindness. A few of the rebels sneak aboard the Death Star, and they lock themselves down to various pieces of equipment. Stirring debates are held on screen among these rebels as to whether they should voluntarily surrender on approach of the troopers or whether they should remain locked down to the end. And in a brilliant and brave touch of authenticity, the rebels are never able to come to consensus. Once inside the Death Star, there's a splinter group that breaks off from those about to lock themselves down. And they rush down a bunch of hallways, and they avoid all the troopers, and they burn a couple transporters, and they use chemicals to etch Galaxy Liberation Front on the walls of the Death Star. And then there's another group that breaks off from them, and they go down all these other hallways, and they make it all the way. They get past all the troopers, make it all the way to Darth Vader's secret headquarters. And he's there all by himself. And they sneak up behind him, and they hit him with a vegan cream pie. Near the end of the movie, there's a debate that's held among the rebels. And that was actually a problem that I had with the environmentalist screenplay, is that there was a bit too much debate and not quite enough action. I'm just saying. As the Death Star looms directly overhead, a few of the rebels actually advocate picking up weapons to fight back. And those rebels are generally shouted down by the pacifist rebels, who argue that attacking those who run the Death Star is just another example of the Empire's harmful philosophy coming in by the back door. They state that the rebels who want to fight back are simply being co-opted by the need to control things. If we want to change Darth Vader, they say, we must first become that change ourselves. To change Darth Vader's heart, we must first change our own. We must above all else have compassion for Darth Vader and remember that he too was once a child. One writer put in the margins, excellent, that will be sure to moisten the cheeks of sensitive people everywhere. He didn't mention whether or not these tears will be a frustration. So finally, Leia, Luke, Han, Chewbacca, and a couple of robots show up, and they tell the others they found a way to blow up the whole Death Star. And everybody's just horrified. Oh, my God, you can't do that. So in the exciting final scene of the environmentalist version, there's a scuffle breaks out between Leia, Luke, Han, and Chewbacca on one side and the pacifists on the other. And the pacifists chase those four from the room and then from the film, which is not a big deal because they were minor characters anyway. So then what happens is the Death Star looms closer and closer, and audience members chew their fingernails as they wait to see whether the letters and petitions and lawsuits work their magic. And then viewers see the lasers inside the Death Star warm up to blow up the planet, and they glow this hellish red, and then you see the planet, you see the Death Star, you see the planet, you see the Death Star, you see the planet, and they, psh, this little spark, and that's the environmentalists getting away before the planet gets blown up. And then, psh, planet gets blown up, which is pretty much the end of the movie. And then the final shot of the movie, which reveals what a complete triumph this was for the rebels, is a still showing an article on the lower left of page 43 of the New Empire Times that devotes a full three sentences to the destruction of the planet. So it's like, yes, we got some press. I did a talk in Asheville, North Carolina a few years ago, and afterwards this one guy said, so how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? I said, I don't know, I'll bite. How many? Come on. And he said, it's not a riddle. I was actually asking you that question. I was like, that's not how this is supposed to work. And then I went back to my hotel, and I was really obsessing about that question, which says more about my social life than I wanted to. And finally an answer came to me, is how many environmentalists does it take to change a light bulb? And the answer is 10. One to write the light bulb a letter requesting that it change, 4 to circulate online petitions, 1 to file a lawsuit demanding that it change, 1 to send the light bulb loving kindness, knowing that's the only way real change occurs, 1 to accept the light bulb precisely the way it is, clear in the knowledge that to not accept another is to do great harm to oneself, 1 to write a book about how and why the light bulb needs to change, and finally, 1 to smash the fucking light bulb because we all know it's never going to change. I have to tell you, by the way, it is really good to be in front of an audience that gets that joke. So as a longtime grassroots environmental activist, and as a creature living in the thrashing endgame of civilization, I am intimately acquainted with the landscape of loss, and have grown accustomed to carrying the daily weight of despair. I've walked clear cuts that wrap around mountains and drop into valleys and climb ridges to fragment watershed after watershed. And I've sat silent near empty streams that 2 generations ago were lashed into whiteness by uncountable salmon coming home to spawn and die. A few years ago, I began to feel pretty apocalyptic, but I hesitated to use that word, in part because of those cartoons I've seen of crazy penitents carrying the end is near signs, and in part because of the power of the word itself, apocalypse. I didn't want to use it lightly. And then a friend and fellow activist said to me, "So, Derek, what's it going to take for you to finally use that word? Will it take the death of runs of salmon so large that you could hear them for miles before you see them, so large that people were afraid to put their boats in the water fear they would capsize, so large?" I just read the other day that even in the 1930s, there was one run of salmon in Alaska that covered the river so you couldn't see the bottom, and they went out into the ocean. It was 12 miles wide, and it lasted 28 days. And I don't know if you know this, but when the Europeans first arrived here, do you know what one of the major impediments to shipping was? Whales. There were so many whales that it was an impediment to shipping. And the fish were so thick in the ocean that it would actually slow down ships. And maybe it'll take the death of flocks of passenger pigeons so large they darken the sky for days at a time, flying 60 miles an hour and sounding like rolling thunder. Maybe it'll take the death of flocks of Eskimo curlews so large that you could close your eyes and shoot a gun, and 15 or 16 of them would fall to the ground, and they were so fat that they would explode when they hit the ground. Maybe it'll take the turning of the sea off San Diego into a dead zone. Maybe it'll take global warming. Maybe it'll take the hole in the ozone. Maybe it'll take the worldwide amphibian death. Maybe it'll take docks and every mother's breast milk. Do you know why there are no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? There were. They were called great auks, and there were so many of them that on one island, a French explorer said that you could load every ship in France and it wouldn't make a dent. Well, they did, and it did, and the last one was killed in the 19th century. So my friend said, "So Derek, give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally use that word apocalypse." A question that a lot of environmentalists ask ourselves is, why do we so often lose? And I think one of the reasons that we so often lose is because I think a lot of us aren't really sure as to what we want. What do you want? Do you want smaller clear cuts, kinder clear cuts, gentler clear cuts? You want to get rid of the designated hitter rule? You know, what is it you want? And I'm pretty clear, in fact, I'm very clear on what I want. And what I want is, I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has less plastic every year than the year before. You know, there's 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in a lot of the oceans. And 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. And I want to live in a world that has more large fish in the oceans every year. I want to live in a world with less dioxin every year than the year before, in every mother's breast milk. I want to live in a world that's not getting burned alive. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. So the first question is, what do we want? Another reason I think that a lot of environmentalists lose, or that we lose so often, has to do with, there's a really great book called The Nazi Doctors by Robert J. Lifton. And in this book, he asks, how is it that men who had taken the Hippocratic Oath could go and work in Nazi death camps? And of course, there were people like Mengele, who was just, you know, horrible and sadistic. But what he found is that many of the people who worked as doctors in the Nazi death camps, many of them actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates. And they would do whatever they could to help the inmates. If they were in pain, they would give them an aspirin to lick. Or they would hide them from the selection officers who were going to kill them. Or they would put them to bed for a day or two. Or they would give them a scrap of potato. These doctors did everything they could except for the most important thing of all, which is they didn't question the existence of the death camp itself. And they didn't question working them to death, starving them to death, gassing them to death. And once again, I say this as an environmentalist, that a lot of times we environmentalists do the same thing. We do everything we can to save this or that scrap of ground, or this or that creature whom we love. We do everything we can except for the most important thing of all, which is we don't question the existence of the larger culture that is turning the whole world into first a work camp and then a death camp. We don't question the larger superstructure that leads inevitably to these atrocities. And that's not good enough for me. It's not good enough that we do our work so that a couple more generations of salmon or grizzly bears or Kootenai sturgeon can live out their harried lives before they're ultimately exterminated. That's not good enough. So, earlier, and you stole my line. It's okay. A question that I've asked all over the country is, no, let's see, you foreshadowed my line. There we go. A question that I've asked all over the country is, do you believe that the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? Do you believe the culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? I asked I've asked thousands of people all over the country. Almost nobody ever says yes. A lot of people laugh. It's a silly question. Of course not. So the next question is, if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, and you care about the land where you live, or you care about life on Earth, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is, we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope. And one of my favorite things to do, and I'll do this later, is to bash hope. I love bashing hope. It's fun for the whole family. So what I want to do for the rest of the talk is I want to go through some of the premises of Endgame, and I want to talk about them explicitly. And the reason I want to go through these premises explicitly is because the first rule of propaganda is, if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. I don't want to do that. And a really great example of this is that Hitler was able to say, so what are we going to do about the Jewish problem? It's like, gosh, Adolf, good question. What are we going to do about the Jewish problem? Well, what he did is he slid by you the idea that there's a Jewish problem that you've got to do something about. It was said of Hitler that from insane premise to monstrous conclusion, Hitler was coldly, icily logical. So once again, once you go with the original premise, you're hooked. But of course, that was a long time ago, and people don't do that nowadays. Except, think about this. You know, some talking head on TV says, so how can we make the U.S. economy grow? Gosh, good question. How can we make the U.S. economy grow? Well, premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. I saw a great bumper sticker the other day, U.S. out of North America. The third premise on that is, who the hell's we? So I want to go through some of the premises now of Endgame. And the first premise is that industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. And it's true of any civilization, but especially industrial civilization. Several years ago, I was riding in a car with a friend of mine, and we were stuck in traffic. And I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology that you wanted, what would it be? And George was not in a very good mood. And he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question. We can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable. That's the Stone Age, and we'll be living there again someday, and the only question really is what's left of the world when we get there. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. In fact, I would say it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. So if you have a finite amount of any resource, doesn't matter what it is, you know, you got 100 units of something, and you base your way of life on it, you know, it's going to be 99, 98, 97, 96... You know, you got a million units, it's still going down. If you base your way of life on a non-renewable resource, by definition, it cannot be sustainable. And so you would think that if we have an entire economy that's based on, I don't know, let's choose a random example, oil. you would ask yourself what you're going to do when the oil runs out. Because, you know, it's a question you might ask. But I'm going to take it a step further. I'm going to say that any way of life that's based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources won't last. By which I mean, if every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually there's not going to be any left. And anybody except for the head of the National Marine Fisheries Services can understand that. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons returned than the year before, eventually there'll be none. If every year there are fewer, you know, whatever it is. I know that this goes against everything we've been taught. You know, we've been taught that evolution is based on competition. It's based on survival of the fittest, or like that motherfucker Richard Dawkins says, not that I hate him or anything, you know, that it's based on absolute selfishness. And, you know, it's basically based on the capitalist model, is what these people are saying. And to show how stupid our discourse is, I can disprove that in one sentence, if you give me a couple semicolons. And that is, those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. How do you think the world got to be so wild and fecund and beautiful in the first place? It's through creatures living and dying and making the world a better place simply by their lives. That's what salmon do. Salmon make the world a better place by their existence. They make the forest a better place by their existence. And the forests, the redwood trees, make the forest a better place by their existence. That's how you survive. Is Dolores LaChapelle talked about how it's not survival of the fittest, it's survival of the fit, by which she means how well you fit into your habitat. And that makes a lot more sense to me. And I'm going to take this a step further. Not only is any way of life that's based on use of non-renewable resources not going to last, and not only is any way of life that's based on a hyper-exploitation of renewable resources not going to last, somebody doesn't want me to say this. I would say that any way of life that's based on the use of resources won't last. And the reason I say that is because resources don't actually exist. And what I mean by that is that salmon don't consider themselves a fisheries resource, and trees don't consider themselves a timber resource. They're just fish, and they're just trees. And this is really important because how you perceive the world affects how you behave in the world. And so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that indigenous people generally have not perceived the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, but rather other beings to enter into relationship with. And there's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them one way. And if when you look at trees, you see trees, you're going to treat them another way. If when I look at this particular tree, I see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. The same is true for fish. If when I look at salmon, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, I'll treat it differently still. Same is true for women. If when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And just because when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, that doesn't mean I can't eat it, by the way. Oh, and I have to tell you, this is kind of an interesting story, that one of the reasons, I mean, it takes me a long time to develop a talk, and one of the reasons it takes so long is because I try out all sorts of transitions, see if this works, doesn't work, and it always bugged me that I went trees, fish, women, and then back to fish. It seems like a weird transition. So one night, I was doing a talk, and I went, just because when I see this particular tree, then the next one is fish, and then women. And then my next line was, just because when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, doesn't mean that I can't eat her. The woman who brought me to do that talk was in her 60s, and she was standing in the back doing her very best Queen Victoria impression. We are not amused. Just drop that one. So just because when I look at this particular fish, I see this particular fish, doesn't mean I can't eat it. I was doing a radio interview in Spokane, Washington, and the radio interviewer said, "So, Indians, they exploited salmon too." I said, "No, they didn't. They ate them." And he said, "What's the difference?" I said, "Well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh." I knew that the answer was kind of bullshit, but I'm a male, and so I'm required by law to answer every question that's asked of me. And so that afternoon, I went out, and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, "What is the fundamental predator-prey relationship?" And the tree gave me the answer right away, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. If you consume the flesh of another, you take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. I don't really mean this in terms of stewardship, which is still more of, sort of hierarchical, but instead responsibility comes from a root meaning respondere, which means to give in return. And everybody knows this. The mergansers know if they eat all the newts in the pond, there's not going to be any newts left, and they won't survive in the long run. Everybody knows this, but we forget. And so... this is really crucial. The part about taking responsibility for the continuation of this community. This one guy one time said to me, "So, Derek, you, because you use toilet paper, you are just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser." And sometimes I can be extraordinarily eloquent, and I was extremely eloquent at that moment. I said, "No." And he said, "Well, go ask a tree." And so I did. I went and asked a tree. I said, "Am I as culpable as the first deforestation, CEO of Weyerhaeuser?" And the tree said, "First off, you're an animal. You consume things. Get over it. And second, yes, you are culpable, but not because you consume the flesh of a tree. You're culpable because you don't fulfill your end of the bargain. You're culpable because you consume the flesh of a tree and you don't take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community by stopping Weyerhaeuser. So we are culpable for much more than just what we consume. We're culpable for not stopping the horrors that we see, or that we don't see, for that matter. And, you know, this is all nice, Derek, you know, all this talk about resources and everything, but what does this have to do with civilization? Well, okay, so remember, industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Well, I've been bashing civilization for a while, and when I wrote Endgame, I decided I probably better finally define it. And so my definition of civilization is any way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? Well, a city I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. People living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And that means that the Talua, on whose land I now live, the Talua Indians, that they were not civilized. They didn't live in cities, they lived in villages, camps. They didn't take more than the land would give. They ate salmon, lamprey, elk, marine mammals, smelt, salmon. And then usually in the winter they would eat a lot of salmon. And they lived there for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. If you believe the myths of the Talua, they lived there since the beginning of time. And in either case, it's a really long time, and they were living sustainably. Well, it's like, I was doing a talk at Princeton a few years ago, and this one guy, when I said the Talua lived for 12,500 years, he said, that doesn't mean they were living there sustainably. I said, okay. And he said, I said, how do you know that? What makes you sure that? He said, because we don't have quantitative analysis showing there's the same number of salmon 12,500 years later as there were 12,500 years ago. I said, you're a science major, aren't you? Said, ooh, wrong audience for that joke. Anyway, so the Talua lived there for a long time, and two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of living can never be sustainable. Because if you've denuded the landscape of that, I mean, if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. As a city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. The second thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence. Because if you require the importation of resources, it means trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over have some resource that you need and they won't trade you for it, you're going to take it. Which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas and the U.S. military would still have to be huge because how else are they going to get access to the oil that they need to run the economy? It's a functional problem. Okay, so that's the first premise right here. So you brought sleeping bags, right? Slumber party, anti-sliv slumber party. Okay, second premise. Traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. We've seen that once or twice on this continent. Okay, third premise. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires... Oh, geez, can you hear me in the back this whole time? Should I start over with Star Wars? You know, it's actually not written by George Lucas. Anyway, our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without persistent and widespread violence. Our way of living is based on, requires, and will collapse very quickly without widespread violence. I was doing a talk in Eugene, Oregon, and this one guy, after the talk, and this wasn't just his previous talk, and this one guy in the audience said, you know, you talk about this culture being so violent, but I just don't see it. I don't allow violence in my life. I'm so nonviolent that I'm not even nonviolent. I'm non-V. And I don't allow it in my life. Nobody gets to say that word around me. It doesn't happen anywhere. And, okay, first off, it's significant that a guy said this because the gold standard study for the rates at which women in this culture are raped is that 25% of the women in this culture are raped in their lifetime, and another 19% fend off rape attempts. And the women I know say that those figures are actually quite low, and they're actually much higher. And so it's much easier for a guy to say, gosh, I don't see any violence, than this for a woman. And second, I said to the guy, so where's your shirt made? And he looked, and his shirt's made in Bangladesh. I said, okay, do we even need to talk about sort of the inherent violence of sweatshops and capitalism? And he said, well, no, I guess not. I said, okay, I got another question for you, which is, So I'm just wondering, do you pay rent? And he said, yeah. I said, why? He said, because I don't own. I said, no. What would happen if you didn't pay rent? He said, well, if I didn't pay rent, then I guess the sheriff would come and evict me. I said, I don't know what that means. What would happen? He said, well, the sheriff would come to my house. I said, stop right there. So the sheriff comes to your house. It's dinner time. So you invite him on. You say, hey, come on in. I'm just making some dinner, so come on into my home. So the sheriff comes in. You eat dinner with him. And then afterwards, you say to him, you know, your company's been kind of pleasant, but not all that pleasant, so I would like for you to leave my home now. What would happen? He says, well, he'd pull out his gun and he'd say, you didn't pay your rent, so I'm here to kick you out of your home. I said, ah, so what you're saying is the reason you pay rent is because if you don't, some guy with a gun's going to come and kick you out of your home. He said, I don't get it. I said, let's try this again. So you go to a grocery store and you're really hungry. So you just start eating. There's a lot of food there, you know. What's going to happen? He said, well, they're going to call the sheriff, and he's going to pull out his gun and take me away. It's probably the same guy. He's a real asshole, isn't he? So part of the reason that a lot of us don't see the violence on which this culture is based is because we're so fully metabolized into the system that we don't understand how crazy it is. We won't even see how crazy it is that you've got to pay somebody in order to live. You've got to pay somebody to have a place to sit down. You've got to pay somebody in order to eat. And in fact, this person that you're paying to eat is probably not a person. It's not some local farmer or farmeress. It's like, are there any food activists in this room? Oh, shoot. Because whenever there's not food activists in the room, I can just make up whatever statistics I want. What is it? How many corporations control like 90% of the grain market? It's like three? Control, is it 90%? Yeah, and it's the same with the beef market, same with the pork market. You know, basically three corporations control. So you're not actually paying a person. You're paying, you know, Cargill or ADM or, you know, Monsanto or whatever. You know, you're paying these awful, nasty, sociopathological corporations. And so we're so fully metabolized in the system, we don't see how crazy that is. And then another reason that we don't see a lot of the violence, because a lot of it's exported. A lot of we don't see. I was doing a talk in Massachusetts a few years ago, and this one guy said, you know, we're living way more sustainably now than we were 100 years ago. And I had another one of those really eloquent responses, like, what? And he said, look around, there's a lot more trees now than there were before. I said, well, look around, I don't see fucking trees. And it's like, well, it's like, no, outside, you know? And so I looked outside, and I said, yeah, the reason there's a lot more trees now is because you get your wood from South America, and you get your corn from Pennsylvania and Iowa. So you're just exporting the violence that is forestry and that is agriculture. So that's why you're not seeing it. Okay, let's go to the fourth premise. Oh, this is my favorite one. This culture is based on a clearly defined and widely accepted, yet often unarticulated hierarchy. Violence done by those higher on the hierarchy to those lower is nearly always invisible. And when it is noticed, it's fully rationalized. Violence done by those lower on the hierarchy to those higher is unthinkable. And when it does happen, it's regarded with shock, horror, and the fetishization of the victims. And we see this all over the place. My family is a great example. My father's extremely violent. My brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. And my father broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And the one time my brother fought back, he was beaten far worse than any other time because he had sent violence up the hierarchy. He committed blasphemy. So that's one example. Another example. Are there bears around here? Yeah, there's bazillions of bears where I live. And my mom has a really good relationship with bears. The bears, they'll literally bring the cubs, like the first day out of the den, they come up to show them off to my mom. And she's got this great relationship. It's like you can't say you've lived until you've seen baby bears boxing, you know? And my mom just told me this yesterday, that yesterday I called her when I got into town, and she said that that day there's a yearling who is just a total pain. She's like some of those kids you see in the grocery store, you know? And you know which ones. And anyway, so her mother left and left the baby there and called her, and the baby wouldn't come. So then the mother came back and then called the baby, and the baby didn't come. The baby's just hanging out. And then so the mother came up and grabbed the baby by the scruff of the neck and started dragging the baby away, and then the yearling, and the yearling got away, and the mother grabbed her by the paw and started dragging her, and then she got away again, and she was trying to run up a tree, and the mother keeps pushing her out of the tree, and it's like, finally, it's like, okay, Mom, I'll come along. Let's see, what's another bear story? One morning, my mom woke up, and there was this huge male bear mooning her through her sliding glass window. I have no idea what message he was trying to send. And what this has to do with violence is sometimes people say, you know, gosh, Derek, you walk through the forest, you know, at night without a flashlight. Aren't you scared? Like, bears are going to kill you or something. And what I know is that there's one person dies in North America every 2 years from bear attacks. And at the same time, there's about 44 or 46,000 people dying in the United States every year from automobile accidents. So we should walk through a forest without really worrying about anything. But then you walk through a parking lot, and it's like, oh, my God, you know, and the car's like, we're going to get you. What's another example? I live 3 miles from the ocean. You know how often I get in the water? Never. You know why? That fucking movie Jaws. I saw that when I was 16. Actually, the acting's really good in that movie, too. Anyway, I swear, I get within about 100 yards of the ocean, I hear that theme music. But what I know is the ratio of human attacks on sharks to shark attacks on humans is literally 20 million to one. What's another example? Am I the only person in this room who's getting kind of tired of 9/11? Okay, so it's like a half dozen is can form a support group. And when was the last time that a politician gave a speech in which they did not mention 9/11? It's 9/10, frankly. And, okay, there were 3,000 people died in those attacks, but there are, and they were a great example of violence flowing up the hierarchy. But there are 15,000 Americans die every 2 weeks from preventable cancers. There are 60,000 people in the world die every day from the direct result of pollution, air pollution, soil pollution, and so on. But those don't count. There are 500,000 children die every year as a direct result of so-called debt repayment from non-industrialized nations to industrialized nations. But once again, those don't count. There are 6,000 Americans die every year from unsafe working conditions. No, 60,000. 6 million. Every American dies every year from... Anyway, so we're very selective on the violence that we perceive and the violence we don't perceive. And here's one more example. Does anybody mind if I swear? The most amazing word in the English language, I think, is fuck. And I think the reason I think that's so amazing is because it's all of patriarchy condensed to four letters. Because it's the conflation of sex and violence, which is really, really, really disturbing. I mean, it's, you know, the same word that means make love to means do great violence to, which is really, really messed up. It's also really confusing because somebody can say, I'm going to fuck you. I'm like... I need more information. So the understanding, by the way, the understanding that, okay, once again, I think that conflating sex and violence is really bad, and it's once again the essence of patriarchy, and that conflation of sex and violence combined with the fact that violence can only flow downward, which means in this culture sex can only flow downward, finally helped me understand homophobia, which I had never understood before, because it always seemed clear to me that if you don't like homosexuals, you probably just shouldn't date one. But then I finally understood this when it was back during one of those episodes of Don't Ask, Don't Tell being all in the news, and you know how you can be in the U.S. military and be gay, but you can't talk about it. Oh, I have to say, by the way, for full disclosure, I have to just let everybody know that I actually agree that homosexuals should not be allowed into the U.S. military. I feel very strongly, in fact, that homosexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military. But then again, I also think that heterosexuals, transsexuals, bisexuals and asexuals should not be allowed in the U.S. military either. Except what if they each had their own army? Like the bisexual brigade to the rescue or something. Anyway, so I finally started to understand homophobia when there was this military spokesman, man, was saying that the reason that homosexuals should not be allowed in the military is because, he said, can you imagine what would happen if a private had sex with a lieutenant? And I was thinking, sure, I can imagine that, but that wasn't his point. He was saying it would destroy chain of command, and not because the lieutenant would fall in love with the private and not be able to order the private to his death, but instead it would destroy chain of command. Notice he said if the private has sex with a lieutenant. He did not say if the lieutenant has sex with the private. See? And this is really important because there's a great line by the great anti-porn activist, Catherine McKinnon. It's a great line by her that is, man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. Man fucks woman, subject, verb, object. And the objectification of women in this culture is so deeply embedded or entrenched that even within the context of a loving heterosexual relationship, it's really hard not to objectify the woman. So the man can say to the woman, I would like to be inside of you. She's the object of the sentence grammatically. Okay, so the woman says to the man, I would like for you to be inside me. But she's still the object of the sentence grammatically. Okay, so the man's going to be all like groovy and feminist, and so he says, I would like for you to be around me. And she's like, you know, the body is willing and the mind has no idea what you're talking about. Oh, so homophobia. What this has to do with homophobia is so I realized that when violence and sex get conflated, which once again is, I think, a very bad thing, when violence and sex get conflated and violence can only flow downhill, which means sex can only flow downhill, that means you have to have a fucker and a fuckee. And the fuckee has to be lower on the hierarchy. So this is where homophobia comes in, because if the fucker and the fuckee are on the same level, all the little tiny brains just seize up. I think I'm sort of beating that one to death. Okay, so if I'm beating an idea to death, is that what I was... Okay. Fifth premise. The property of those higher in the hierarchy is more valuable than the lives of those below. It is acceptable for those above to increase the amount of property they control in everyday language to make money by destroying or taking the lives of those below. This is called production. Really, what is production? Production is the conversion of the living to the dead. It's the conversion of a living mountain into coal resource, first in your head and then in the real world. It's a conversion of a living river into hydroelectricity. It's a conversion of a living forest into 2x4s. If those below damage the property of those above may kill or otherwise destroy the lives of those below. This is called justice. Sixth premise. The culture is not redeemable. The culture will not undergo any sort of voluntary transformation to a sane, sustainable way of living. If we don't put a halt to it, this culture will continue to immiserate the vast majority of humans and to degrade the planet until it, civilization, and probably the planet, collapses. The effects of this degradation will continue to harm humans and non-humans for a very long time. I want to be really clear. Every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. I just don't believe it's going to happen, and I don't want to bet the world on it. Every cell in my body wants it. And I also want to be really clear. When I talk about fighting back, what do I mean? That doesn't have to mean picking up a weapon. It can mean it. Only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. Only 2%. 98% are doing all sorts of other work. I really mean it when I say that we need it all. Fighting back could be picking up, you know, could be filing lawsuits. It could be doing technical work. It could be picking up weapons. It could be anything. And another thing that's really important is that I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. And this is part of the reason lately I've been kicked out of the anarchy club. And part of the reason I've been kicked out is because I don't believe in the reform versus revolution dichotomy. And one of the reasons I don't believe in it is because if we all wait for the great glorious revolution, there's not going to be anything left anyway. And at the same time, if all we do is reform work, this culture is going to grind away until there's nothing left. So once again, we need it all. And the point for me at which the reform versus revolution dichotomy fell apart is where I used to teach creative writing at Pelican Bay State Prison, which is a super maximum security prison in Northern California. And every day when I walked in, I was fully aware that I was participating in the biggest racist gulag on the planet. And at the same time, a lot of my students were telling me that the only things that were keeping them sane were our classes. So we can all wait for some pure revolution, But what are we going to do in the meantime? And at the same time, once again, if all you do is reform work, that's not good enough. You know, Harriet Tubman did not stop slavery, but she stopped slavery for some of the people who were enslaved. And so once again, we need it all, which doesn't alter the fact that there's not going to be a voluntary transformation, I don't believe. And so what does that mean? What are we going to do about that? Okay, premise 7. The longer we wait for civilization to crash, or the longer we wait before we ourselves bring it down, the messier will be the crash, and the worse things will be for those humans and non-humans who live during it and for those who come after. The longer we wait, the worse things are going to be. If somebody would have brought down civilization 200 years ago, if Tecumseh would have won, people in this area could still eat passenger pigeons. If somebody would have brought it down 100 years ago, people in the Pacific Northwest could still eat salmon. There's going to be people sitting along the banks of the Columbia River 50 years from now. They'll be glowing, for one thing, because of Hanford. And they will also be saying, I'm starving to death because you didn't take out the dams that were killing salmon. God damn you. The longer we wait, once again, if somebody would have brought down civilization 100 years ago, we wouldn't have to worry quite so much about global warming. You know, it's like, how bad? We wouldn't have to worry about plastics. We wouldn't have to worry about dioxin. How bad does it have to get? You know, in 50 years from now, people are going to be saying, if somebody would have brought it down 50 years ago, there'd still be amphibians. There'd still be migratory songbirds. It's like I saw this study the other day that migratory songbird populations have collapsed in the Northeast along the Atlantic seaboard. Many of the songbird populations have collapsed by up to 80% in the last 40 years. I'm thinking, holy shit, that's terrible, until I realized 40 years ago is after Silent Spring, which means there's a declining baseline, which means they've declined 80% from having declined 80% from probably having declined 80%. It's like, how bad do things have to get? Are people 50 years from now going to be saying, if somebody would brought it down, there'd still be great apes, there'd still be great cats? You know, it's like, how bad does it have to get? Next premise, 8th premise. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. The needs of the natural world are more important than the needs of the economic system. I've just guaranteed I will never hold public office. Another way to put the 8th premise is, any economic or social system that doesn't benefit the natural communities on which it's based is unsustainable, immoral, and really stupid. Sustainability, morality, and intelligence requires the dismantling of any such economic or social system, or at the very least, disallowing it from damaging your land base. The only means by which we will be judged by the people who come after is the health of the land. They're not going to care whether we were violent or nonviolent. They're not going to care about whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green. They're not going to care if we recycled. They're not going to care if we were nice. They're not going to care if we wrote really big books. What they're going to care about is whether they can drink the water and breathe the air. We can all fantasize all we want about some groovy eco-socialist utopia with free love for everybody, and I do fantasize about that. If you can't breathe the air, it doesn't matter. It's embarrassing to have to say that what's real is what's real. I was doing a radio interview in San Diego or Santa Barbara a while ago, and the guy was some anti-environmental property rights uberallist Bible thumper who wanted to yell at an environmentalist. And I didn't know this going in. So I was talking about how 90% of large fishing oceans are gone, sharks getting hammered, salmon getting hammered, docks in everyone's breast belt. And this guy kept saying the same thing, which is, that's all fine, Derek, but let's get back to the real world. I was like, I thought we were talking about the real world. And finally I realized that for him, the real world is industrial capitalism. And that's how people use it. They say, come on, propose a realistic solution. And what that always means is propose a solution you can get by the Democrats and Republicans and the corporations that own them. And people, students use that language too. It's like a lot of students will say to each other, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what that means is, what are you going to do when you have to get a fucking job? Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do when I get out in the real world. I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? That's the real world. Oh, and I want to say one more thing about this before I move on a little bit more, which is that I'm not so smart as my books make me seem. That in the books, what will happen is there'll be a conversation where my friend says something really smart, and then I say something really smart back, and then my friend says something smart, and I say something smart, and it's like we're both so brilliant, it's not even amazing. But what really happened is my friend says something really smart, and then I said, God, that's really smart. And then I call him back in about a month, or her back in about a month, and then my friend says something really smart, and then I say, I'll call you back in a month. And an example of that was this interview with this guy, this radio guy, his name was Andy, The last thing he said to me is, he said, you know, it's very clear, Derek, that you have no appreciation for the fact that God gave man dominion over the earth. And my answer was really terrible. It was, well, if you try to express dominion over something, it means you're not going to be in a relationship with it and you're going to eventually kill it. It's like it was putting me to sleep. And then about 12 hours later, I came up with the answer. I wish I would have had his home phone. I would have called him up. And I would have said, Andy, no, actually, I do have a great appreciation for the fact that God gave man dominion over the earth. In fact, just last night I was talking to God, and God said, you know, when I said that man has dominion over the earth, I wasn't specific enough. What I really meant is you, Derek, have dominion over the earth. And in fact, you, Derek, especially have dominion over everybody named Andy. So what this means, Andy, is that everything that's yours, I get. And if you don't like it, me and my fellow Derekistians are going to come and take it. And he would have said, it doesn't say that in the Bible. And I would have said, I can't help it if you read the wrong Bible. Okay, so before we get to the ninth premise, I have to say that there are a few things that I cannot talk about. I can talk about most anything. I can bash a lot of things and nobody cares. You know, I can bash civilization, nobody cares. I can bash corporations, nobody cares. I can bash, you know, the so-called democracy we live in, nobody cares. I can bash, you know, Christianity, nobody cares. All those things, nobody cares. But there are three things I can't bash. One of them is I can't bash science, because as soon as I start to bash science, I can feel the sphincters in the audience start to quiver. The next thing I can't bash is I can't bash Buddhism, because you can't say you've lived until you've been chased down the street by a bunch of angry pacifists. And then the next thing I can't bash is I can't talk about the fact that there are more humans on the planet than the planet can support. Because as soon as you start talking about the fact that there are too many humans on the planet, more humans than the planet can support, immediately people say, you must not like babies. And the truth is, I don't really like babies. Except with this really good barbecue sauce out of Kansas City. It's a joke. I mean, you know, I gotta tell you, I told that joke in Hamilton, Ontario, and the whole place burst into applause. I said, I don't understand. And this one guy in the audience said, it's a Hamilton thing, man. I said, I don't want to know anything more about this. So humans have exceeded carrying capacity. Carrying capacity is the number of any given species who can live in a place forever. You can have an island with a carrying capacity of 1,000 deer, and 1,000 deer could live there forever. And you can temporarily have the deer overshoot carrying capacity. You have 10,000 deer there for a while, and what they'll do is they'll eat too much and shit too much and scrape away at the land too much, and they'll permanently reduce carrying capacity. And, oh, I gotta tell you, you know, people always say there is no such thing as a stupid question. That is so not true. I get them all the time. And I got one night where I was talking about how humans have exceeded carrying capacity. This guy got so mad, he was sputtering. He said, how dare you say that humans have exceeded their capacity to care? Well, that may be, but that's not really what we're talking about. But thank you for playing. So humans have exceeded carrying capacity. Having said that, I want to say that I don't think the population is a primary problem. I think population is a secondary problem. And the reason I think that is because I think consumption is more important than population. And the reason this is important is because when I talk about population, or when I think about population, honestly, the first thing I think about is some small child in Mexico City with a big distended belly from malnutrition. And when I think about overconsumption, the first thing I think about is a fucking Canadian. You know, they consume more resources per capita than people in the United States do. It's their fault. The first thing I think about is somebody from the United States or Canada or Europe. And who causes more harm to the planet? Someone from the United States or a subsistence farmer in India with five children? You know, who's causing more harm here? It's really clear that consumption is once again more important. I'm not saying that there aren't more humans on the planet can support. There are. But consumption, I think, is more important than actual population. Because you could have 100 gazillion people, if they didn't eat, shit, or stand anywhere, it wouldn't matter. So once again, the important thing is how much harm you do, and clearly industrialized people do a lot more harm. But I don't actually think that the population is a secondary problem either. I think the population is a tertiary problem. And the reason I think population is a tertiary problem is, are there any demographers in here? Good. I hate demographers. Just kidding. The reason I kind of hate demographers is because sometimes they talk about something called a natural rate of population increase, which is where you have X population, then over time, it goes up exponentially. And that presumes that people breed like rabbits. But I don't think that people breed like rabbits. I don't even think rabbits breed like rabbits. I think that people, including rabbit people, make rational family planning decisions based upon their personal and social circumstances. And I'm for crying out loud, if you have a worm bin and you limit the amount of food that you give to the worms, they limit the number of babies they have. And they don't even have a brain. They do, however, have three hearts, which means maybe they have a greater capacity to care. Which is just the crappiest joke in history. Anyway, so the reason this is important is because, let's say you have one culture where all of your mythologies are cyclical, and they're spirals and circles, and in this culture you have, you've been living in place for 12,000 years, and you're planning on living in place for another 12,000 years. And in this culture, you recognize harm to the natural world as harm to the natural world, and you recognize that that is going to harm you and your community. You're going to make one set of family planning decisions in this community. You have another community over here where your mythologies are linear. They're progressive. You have a beginning, middle, end. And you've made a fetish out of growth. I mean, who's the idiot who came up with the idea of infinite growth on a finite planet? So you have this culture over here where your mythologies are linear, they're progressive. You don't perceive damage to the natural world as damage to the natural world. And in this culture, somebody wrote a book, and in this book they said that you should go forth and multiply. And this book becomes a really big bestseller. Okay, these people are going to make different rational family planning decisions than these people over here. Another way to say all this is that there were more than 250 different plants that were used as contraceptives and abortifacients by the native North Americans prior to the arrival of Europeans. And it was the women who made the choice to use these plants. Can you imagine? What a bunch of fucking primitives, you know? That was irony, by the way. I got to tell you this story. About 140 years ago or so, 130 years ago, whenever, these male anthropologists went to talk to some indigenous peoples about what they use for contraception. And because, of course, the men are the only ones worth talking to, they asked the men, how do you not have babies? And the men of these groups said, it's a secret. And so the anthropologists went back, and they said, well, you know, indigenous peoples don't know where babies come from. And so later, some female anthropologists went out and they talked to the same people, and they asked the women, what do you use for contraception? And the women said, well, when you're 16, you take this certain root, and you eat it, and then that makes you sterile for 5 years, and then when you're 21, you can then, if you want to have a baby, you eat this, and if you don't want to have a baby, you eat this. And the men are like, really? I had no idea. Okay, all this is a long way of getting to the ninth premise, which is, although there will clearly someday be far fewer humans than there are at present, there are many ways this reduction in population could occur. Some of these ways would be characterized by extreme violence and privation. Nuclear Armageddon, for example, would certainly reduce both population and consumption, yet would do so horrifically. The same would be true for a continuation of overshoot followed by crash. Other ways would not have to be characterized by violence. And personally and collectively, we may be able to both reduce the amount and soften the character of violence that occurs during this shift. We may not. But this much is certain. If we don't approach it actively, if we don't talk about our predicament and what we're going to do about it, the violence will be far more severe and the privation more extreme. The point is, we're in deep trouble, and if we don't talk about what we're going to do about it, it's just going to be worse. I mean, once again, every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation. If I ran for president, I would run on a platform of vasectomies on the house, you know? I even have a campaign slogan. You ready? It's a snip in every sack. So Okay, but this actually brings up a hugely important question if we're going to talk about bringing down civilization, or talk about it coming down at all, which is, I did two talks in one day at this place, and there was this one woman who hated what I had to say so much that she came to both talks. And she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And I hit the trifecta. And the reason is because I want to deindustrialize, and deindustrialization will kill a lot of people, therefore, and they're all mass murderers, therefore I'm like them. And I didn't like her rhetoric, but she raises a very, very important point, which is, what do you do about the fact that at this point in history, no matter what you do, your hands are blood red? Because if you participate in the global economy, you got blood all over your hands. If you don't participate in the global economy, but you allow it to continue, you got blood all over your hands, because a refusal to decide is still a decision. If you, it's like after the Allies invaded France on D-Day, some of the German generals who'd been plotting against Hitler for years, they recognized that the war was as good as over at this point. And so they asked themselves, should we call off the assassination attempt and call off the coup attempts? Because, you know, it's pretty much just a done deal now. And Henning von Treskow, who's one of my heroes, he's a member of the Wehrmacht at that time, he said, no, because there are 16,000 people who are being murdered every day by the Nazis. And so we need to bring it down sooner. And it's the same, you know, every day, 120 species are going extinct every day. And your hands are blood red if you don't stop it. But if you do act, your hands are blood red. And it's humans, too. We'll talk about this in a second. So the point is, what do you do with the fact that no matter what you do, your hands are blood red? And I got a bunch of responses to that. My first is that my definition of bringing down civilization is this. I want to deprive the rich of their ability to steal from the poor and to deprive the powerful of their ability to destroy the planet. You know, who but a capitalist or a sociopath, insofar as there's a difference, could actually disagree with that? But that's nice, Derek, but a lot of people are going to die. Okay, I got another answer, which is bringing down civilization is not a monolithic act. It's a bazillion acts done by a bazillion different people, including a bazillion non-human people, and they all have different moralities. And it's like, I don't care what your motivation is, you cannot make a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. I don't care what your motivation. Oh, yeah, I guess if you're bringing freedom and democracy to a country, then it's okay. No, seriously, I don't care what your motivation is. You cannot make a moral case for blowing up a children's hospital. On the other hand, you cannot make a moral case against taking out cell phone towers. I mean, cell phone towers are just nasty. On one level, you know, they allow that jerk at the next table to yammer on when you're trying to eat. And, oh, my God. So it's like, you know, I've been complaining about that for about 10 years. It used to be the whole audience would explode. Yeah, that's terrible. And now there's, like, us too. Everybody else is like, what's wrong with that, man? Okay, so fine. We're the only ones who care about that. The next thing is, those cell phone towers, they put out those Anyway, they get in your head, and then you have to wear the aluminum beanie, and if you put it on wrong side out, all the thoughts bounce back and forth inside your... Okay, we'll move on. That doesn't happen. Okay. Okay. Well, also, cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds every year. They're significant killers of migratory songbirds, and you can't make a moral case against taking them out. That's nice, Derek, but a lot of people are going to die. Well, I got another answer, which is, which people are you talking about? You talking about hammerhead shark people? You talking about coho salmon people? You talking about chimpanzee people? You're talking about right whale people? I think if you ask polar bears if we should bring down civilization, they'd say, yeah. If you ask prairie dogs if we should bring down civilization, they would say, yip, 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 yip. But, you know, they're non-human, so they don't count, right? Well, okay, let's ask it again. If you bring down civilization, a lot of people are going to die. Which people are you talking about? A few years ago, I asked Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow. And she laughed and said, of course. And she said there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And so there are people starving to death in India right now because of the global economy. So do you think that the subsistence farmers who are being forced off their land would be better off if the global economy disappeared tomorrow? Of course. What about the traditional indigenous people? Well, of course. What about the people that just broke ground on a new dam in Burma for electricity for some city in China? And what about the people who live there, the human people too? What about them? So I think we need to be more careful when we say, you know, okay, I think that if we brought down civilization, what about the people who don't have electricity right now? Are they going to give a shit if the electrical grid goes down? Of course not. The rural poor, the world over, would be better off if civilization were brought down immediately. You want to talk instant land reform? You got it. The rural rich, they got guns. They'd be fine. The urban rich, they're the problem. Fuck them. The urban poor, that's a real problem. And I'm not saying this blithely at all. It's a huge problem because... Oh, and I need to say also that when I talk about bringing down civilization, people dying, I'm not talking abstractly. I have Crohn's disease, and I am reliant upon high-tech medicines for my life. And when the grid comes down, I'm in the second wave of dead. I'm dead in 3 or 4 months. So I'm not talking about this abstractly, but I also recognize that the health of the land is more important than any human life, including my own. And anyway, back to the urban poor. One of the things that is... tragic, I think maybe is the word, about this culture, and one of the things that's just horrible is that it has systematically made us dependent for our very lives upon the system that is exploiting us and others. And so the urban poor, the world over, are reliant upon the very system that is killing the planet. And this affects all of us, because one of the reasons we don't resist is because if your experience is that your food comes from a grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings those to you because your life depends upon it. Your loyalty has been shifted to there. As opposed to, if your food comes from a land and your water comes from a river, people used to drink from rivers, can you believe that? And you will defend to the death that land and that water because your life depends on it. One of the things that this culture has been very successful and intentionally successful at doing is inserting itself between us and the source of all life so that we get confused and we start to think that this culture is the source of life because it is our experience. My food comes from the grocery store. And this is abuse 101. This is what abusers do in domestic violence situations, is cut you off from your support network. Okay, great. We're in a terrible situation. That's nice, Derek. A lot of people are going to die. Well, I got another answer, which is I can guarantee that as civilization collapses, 100% of the misery caused by that collapse is going to be caused by those whose lifestyles are already killing the planet, attempting to maintain those lifestyles. And one of the things I mean by that is that almost every time there's a famine, people are not actually dying of starvation. Because most of the countries that experience famine are actually net food exporters at that time. So they're not dying of starvation, they're dying of colonialism. So, for example, the great Irish potato famine, Ireland was actually a net exporter of food at that point, exporting grain to England. And almost all of them, I mean, some of the African ones that are, the African famines that are happening right now, they're exporting flowers to Europe, they're exporting green beans to Europe, soy to Europe. And so once again, they're not, the same thing is true of water. You know, we hear all the time, the world's running out of water, world's running out of water. People are dying of thirst because the world's running out of water. Bullshit. The world's not running out of water. What's happening is the water's being stolen. Because 90% of the water used by human beings is used for agriculture and industry. And so we hear all the time, oh my gosh, take shorter showers, because then, you know, if you take shorter showers, then that'll save the world. But basically, taking shorter showers, all it's going to do is ruin your social life. Because... the same amount of water is used by municipal humans is used for municipal golf courses. So if you really want to save water, I got a better idea than taking a shorter shower, which is take out the golf courses. It's like if all the dams on the Colorado River were to fail, I'm just saying. And the Colorado River were once again to reach the ocean. How weird would that be? You know, the capitalist press would bray as one that people in Arizona are going to die of thirst and California are going to die of thirst. It's like, I wouldn't want to hear one word of complaint so long as there existed a single irrigated alfalfa field, a single irrigated citrus orchard, a single golf course, a single water park, a single lawn, so long as Las Vegas still existed. I wouldn't want to hear a single word of complaint. It's like Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, she said the reason they need to raise the Shasta Dam is because, quote, it is Californians' God-given right to water their lawn. You cannot argue with that logic, except with explosives. And another way to think about all this is that, once again, a lot of this whole talk is about this inversion of what's real, that when people talk about stopping global warming, when all the mainstream so-called solutions to global warming, what do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. They take industrial capitalism as that which must be saved. I mean, even somebody as smart as Peter Montague, who put out the indispensable Rachel's newsletter, he could say that one of the reasons that carbon sequestration is a bad idea is because if all the carbon leaked out at once after it was stored, it could, quote, disrupt civilization as we know it. It's like, no, Peter, it could end life on Earth. And so what is important? What's real? It's like, you know, Lester Brown with his plan B7.93B5 to save civilization. It's like, at what point do you give up on saving civilization and start trying to save the real world? You know, where is your loyalty? What is it that's important to you? You know, it's like, if you ask a child how you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they'll tell you. In fact, I just asked a 7-year-old the other day, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas? And she said, by stopping burning oil and gas. I said, hey, you know what? You're smarter than Al Gore. And I mean, think about this. You walk in your bathroom and you see that the tub is overflowing and the water's running in the tub. It's overflowing all over the floor. Okay, what's the first thing you do? Well, I can tell that the person who said turn off the water is not an environmentalist. Because if you're an environmentalist, what you do is you apply to Pew Charitable Trust for a grant in order to get some solar photovoltaics to put on the roof to power a pump that will take the water from the bathroom, put it through a gray water system, and then water your permaculture garden. And I have just insulted everybody in the room. So, I mean, when people say that they want to stop global warming in general, they're not saying that they want to stop global warming. What they're saying is they want to stop global warming without stopping the burning of oil and gas. And the real question is, how do you stop global warming without stopping the burning of oil and gas? And the answer is you don't. It's like when people say they want to save salmon, what they're really saying is they want to save salmon without removing dams, stopping industrial logging, stopping industrial fishing, stopping industrial agriculture, stopping the murder of the oceans, or stopping global warming. How do you save salmon without doing any of those things? You don't. Well, that's depressing. I want to mention, we've talked a little bit about dams. I just want to mention that there are, you know how many dams are in the United States? There's 2 million dams. Talk about obsessive. There are 60,000 dams over 13 feet tall, 70,000 dams over 6.5 feet tall. And if we only took out one of those 70,000 dams a day, it would take 200 years. Salmon don't have that time. And sturgeon don't have that time. So people a lot of times they say, oh gosh, Derek, you're so non-compromising. Okay, here's a compromise. 5 dams a day, 40 years. Done deal. Okay, which kind of leads us to the 10th premise of the book, which is the culture as a whole and most of its members are insane. We don't need to talk about that, do we? The culture is driven by a death urge, an urge to destroy life. I don't know if this ever happens to you, but sometimes I'll be doing something else, and suddenly a vision of Angelina Jolie will appear before me. And she'll stand suspended in space. You know, for a while when that would happen, it would make me happy. it used to scare me. And now it scares me again, actually, because I was just at the grocery store the other day, and I saw that Brad Pitt's bodyguard caught him kissing Jennifer Aniston. It's like, this is going to break up Brad and Angelina, maybe. I thought some things lasted forever. I mean, and I thought they were really good for each other. And, it just breaks my heart. You know, back when she was with, oh, my God, I can't even say his name. He's so nasty. When she was with Billy Bob, do you know where she had his name tattooed? Oh, my God, I bet she was wishing his name was Ed. Speaking of genitals, did you know that Nicole Kidman does not like to wear underwear? I read that in the newspaper, so it must be true. What's the indigenous name for this place right here? I'm sorry? Okay, and how about the local, this place? Okay, can you say both of those names for everybody again?
It is insane, literally, in terms of being out of touch with physical reality.
That I know what is on Angelina Jolie's genitals and what is not on Nicole Kidman's, which will never affect my life. And it took me about 2 years of living where I do to learn that there was a massacre of about 250 Talo about 2 miles from where I live at a place called Yontaket. Another massacre over here at a place called Awanket. Another massacre at a place over here called Achillet. It's crazy that I know that so far Carlos Silva, of all people, is having a good year for the Cubs, if you can believe that nonsense. And I know, that's insane on its own. It's insane that I know that. I know that Pedro Martinez still doesn't have a contract, even though he pitched pretty well last year. But I can't name 10 species of edible plants and fungi within 100 yards of my home. That's insane. I'm going to try it. Okay, we got blackberry. We got two types of blackberry. I'm going to need all the ones I can get. We got Himalayan blackberry and native blackberry. We got salmonberry, thimbleberry, salal, huckleberry. Chanterelles, blackberries. Oh, and we got those big red mushrooms with white dots. I was thinking, if I ate one of those, I could take out a dam all by myself. So one of the reasons we don't defend the places we live is because we don't live there. We live with Brad and Angelina, and we live long ways away. Okay, so what I'd like to do now, I've got one, I want to do two more premises, and then, oh, shoot, I forgot something. Okay, let's back up. I forgot my best answer of all to that woman about what do you do, that no matter what you do, your hands are blood red. I'm sorry, I forgot my final answer. This is my final answer. So just pretend I put this in back there. Okay, but this is really important. That's why I got to come back to it. So if you've gotten this far on this book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably don't have much to say to each other. How about Carlos Silva? We probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who'll be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, the civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan. They can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate, or if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge, It can look like starting rooftop gardens, actually gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs, and it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Likewise, people growing medicinal plants in preparation for the end of civilization do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility, at the very least, to not condemn those people who have chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love. Do what you love. Do what you can. Do what best serves your land base. We need it all. That doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they'll thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. That doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It's contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. So what we have now with the rest of the talk is I want to do two more premises, and then I want to bash hope, and then read two short things. Okay. So the next premise, the 11th premise, is we should acknowledge that from the beginning this culture, civilization, has been a culture of occupation, and the government is a government of occupation. And, of course, all of my American Indian friends say, what the hell took you so long to figure this one out? What does a government of occupation do? It moves in, it extracts resources, and facilitates production, maximizes production. What does the U.S. government do? It moves in, facilitates resource extraction, and maximizes production. How many people in this room believe that the government takes better care of corporations on one hand, humans on the other? Corporations? Humans? Really? Bunch of fucking commies. So, what would that mean if we internalize the understanding that we don't really live in a democracy? How would that change our activism? How would that change our actions? What would we do? I want to read a short thing about that. That if Nazis or other fascists took over North America, what would we do? What would we do if they implemented Mussolini's definition of fascism? Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it's a merger of state and corporate power. What if this occupied country called itself a democracy, but most everyone understood elections to be shams, with citizens allowed to choose between different wings of the same fascist or following Mussolini corporate party? It's like, I remember back in the 70s and 80s, it was so fun to laugh at the Soviet Union because 98% of the Politburo members were all Communist Party members. It's pretty damn funny. But what percentage of members of the House of Representatives and Senate are Capitalist Party members? Guess who's laughing now, you know? What if anti-government activity was opposed by stormtroopers and secret police? Would you fight back? If there already existed a resistance movement, would you join it? Now, would you resist if the fascists irradiated the countryside, poisoned food supplies, made rivers unfit for swimming, and so filthy you wouldn't even dream of drinking from them anymore? What if they did this because... I can't finish that sentence because no matter how I try, I can't come up with a motivation good enough even for fascists to irradiate and intoxify the landscape and water supplies. If fascists systematically deforested the continent, would you join an underground army of resistance, head to the forest, and from there to the boardrooms, the halls of the Reichstag, to pick off the occupying deforesters, and most especially those who give them their marching orders? And what would we do if space aliens came down from out... That's where they come from. If aliens came down from outer space, and they started to systematically deforest the whole planet, and they were vacuuming the oceans, and they were changing the climate, and they were putting docs in every mother's breast milk, what would we do if they did this? And we know what we would do. We would grab our camo outfits, we'd grab our AK-47s, we would head up. Wrong audience. Am I the only person here with an AK-47? I was sharing the stage with Ward Churchill one time, and after my talk, he was in the audience, and I asked that question, am I the only person here with an AK-47? The whole place was just silent. I hear this one voice go, nope. Okay, so maybe your sense of kin and your sense of skin doesn't extend to the natural world. Maybe you don't yet love the land where you live enough that you'd fight for it. But what if the fascists toxify not only the landscape but the bodies of those you love? What if their actions put dioxin and dozens of other carcinogens into the flesh of your lover, children, mother, brother, sister, father? Would you fight back? How many people in here have had someone you love die of cancer? It's like 70%. Cancer, of course, is a disease of civilization caused in great measure by the toxification of the total environment. Oh, sorry, it's caused by a cancer gene. What if the fascists toxify your own body? Would you still cling to the illusion their edicts carry more weight than that brought to bear by their secret and not-so-secret police? Would you work for this regime? Would you teach others its virtues, or would you fight back? It's like, I got an email. After I wrote Endgame, I got an email from this policeman in Chicago, and he wrote and said he thought that I was giving cops kind of too hard a time, which I don't really give cops a hard time in a game. But he said I was kind of hard on him. He said, it's not our fault. Our job is to protect people from sociopaths. And I wrote back and I said, yeah, I totally agree with you. And I think it's great when cops protect us from sociopaths. But one of the concerns I have is you really only protect us from poor sociopaths. You don't protect us from the rich sociopaths. And also, why is it that whenever there's a strike and the cops are called in, why does they always break the heads of the strikers? Why don't they ever break the heads of the capitalists to force them to terms? And he didn't write back. But I think those are really good questions, and I think we should open a dialogue on that. Anyway, if you won't fight back when they toxify your own body, when precisely will you fight back? Because you know that's happened in many countries where the police have been really central to resistance. Give me, and more importantly yourself, a specific threshold which you finally take a stand. If you can't, I won't give the threshold. Why not? And part of this whole thing about decolonizing, you know, that recognizes government occupation, is we need to stop saying we in terms of we're not killing the planet, warehouses killing the planet. We need to separate ourselves from them. It's like a friend of mine called up and said, so, Derek, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Afghanistan? I said, we're in Afghanistan? I thought we're Northern California. And she said, how much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Afghanistan? I said, I got troops? Holy shit, will they do what I tell them? If I tell them to take out the Grand Coulee, will they do it? She said, this is why I only call you once every 6 weeks. Okay, and I just want to say again that, you know, when I talk about fighting back, that doesn't have to mean picking up weapons. It can be picking up lawsuits. It can be picking up anything. But then having said that, I do want to talk very briefly about one final premise before I go to Bashing Hope, which is that the 15th premise of the book is that love does not imply pacifism. And one of the reasons I wrote Endgame is because a lot of times when I would talk about capital F fighting back against those in power, the response I got by the audience was pretty predictable. And that is that those who... A lot of sort of mainstream environmentalists, a lot of sort of mainstream peace and social justice activists would put up what I've taken to calling a Gandhi shield, which is they would say the names Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Dalai Lama again and again real fast to keep all evil thoughts at bay. And then grassroots environmentalists would do the same thing, but then they would come up to me afterwards and they would say, thank you so much for bringing this up. And then other groups of people had different responses. And these are a lot of survivors of domestic violence, a lot of people of color, American Indians, a lot of the poor, some gang kids, prisoners, family farmers. A lot of them would look at me like, so tell us something I don't know. Let's go, bro. And what I came to realize is that for those latter groups, violence is not a spiritual or abstract question to be puzzled through. It's simply a part of life, and you deal with it. And it doesn't mean you participate. It doesn't mean you don't participate. It just means it's a part of life and you don't reify it. You don't make it into something it's not. And then also, a lot of the responses were pretty predictable in that people would throw out a lot of the same old cliches. And I got so tired of hearing you can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house that I wanted to write this little pamphlet that would just respond to some of those cliches and then hand it to people. And this little pamphlet turned into a 1,000-page book. And tonight, with me talking on, you can see why. So I want to go through a couple of those. One of them is the whole idea that love implies pacifism, that people would say, you know, if you love enough, you could never consider fighting back. But love, if you love, you actually could never commit any act of violence anywhere. And I actually don't agree, and I think that Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on this one. I grew up in the country, and I have in my life been attacked by mother horses, cows, dogs, cats, chickens, ducks, geese, hawks, eagles, spiders, and mice who thought I was attacking their babies. And if a mother mouse will take on someone 6,000 times her size and win, what the hell's wrong with us? I don't think it's true that we need to love the CEOs. Like, if you just love the CEOs, then something good will happen. I do think it is true, though, that we need to love more. But I don't think we need to love the CEOs. I think we need to love ourselves. I think we need to love the land where we live. Because I think if we loved ourselves, we wouldn't allow our communities to be destroyed by distant corporations. And we wouldn't allow the water to be polluted. And we wouldn't allow a government that we recognize is openly anti-democratic. We would do something about that. So I do think we need to love, but not them. Oh my gosh, but there's the word them, you know? We don't need to love our enemies. But oh my God, Derek, the enemy. You can't talk about enemy, because enemy, that's dualistic, that's divisive. And we cannot be dualistic because dualism's bad. And so, oh, okay, so what you're saying is that dualism is bad and non-dualism is good. Checkmate. Because the truth is, there is a time to be dualistic and a time to be not dualistic. And there is a time to fight back and there is a time not to fight back. And there is a time to reap and a time to sow. And I feel a song coming on. Okay, and the next thing that is said a lot of times is you can't use the master's tool to dismantle the master's house. And I love Audre Lorde. I think she's amazing. She's wonderful. But I'll tell you two things. One of them is the people who quote that all the time have never read the essay from which it comes, because what Audre Lorde's really talking about is taking a multivariate approach to a problem that's multivariate, which is all I'm talking about too. Pretty straightforward. The other thing I can tell you is that Audre Lorde never worked construction, because it's a terrible fucking metaphor. Because the truth is, it doesn't matter whose tools you use. You can use your tools to dismantle the master's house. You can use my tools. You can use your Uncle Jed's tools. You can steal tools from Walmart. It doesn't matter. And it presumes also that violence is one of the master's tools. Well, those in power tell us that they own the land. They tell us they own the trees. They tell us they own the water. They tell us they own genetic materials. I'll be goddamned if I give them violence too. And I think Mother Grizzly Bears will back me up on that one as well. Okay, then there's two more that I want to mention, which is that one of them is, one of the things that's thrown out a lot, I can't believe this. How many people in here have my book, A Language Older Than Words? And those of you who have that book, how many of you have a straight razor? Okay, so take the chapter Violence Revisited and cut it out and crumple it up, and then since it's Earth Week, recycle it. Because in that chapter, I say something that is one of the stupidest things that anybody has ever said in the history of the planet. It's like admitting to being a compulsive masturbator, which I'm not. In that chapter, I say that if you fight back, you run the risk of becoming like they are. That is so stupid. So what that means is that Tecumseh, by fighting back, ran the risk of becoming like the people who are stealing their land? Does this mean that the woman who kills a rapist runs the risk of becoming a rapist? Does this mean that a tiger who kills a zookeeper runs the risk of becoming a zookeeper? It doesn't make any sense. And the final one, the trump card that's always thrown out, is that violence never accomplishes anything. That is even stupider than what I said. Because what this means is all the Africans who came over on the slave trade, they came over in the Middle Passage, what that means is that force was not used. This means violence was not used to enslave them. This means they had really bad travel agents. This means all the American Indians, when they saw the Europeans, they said, hey, you want some land? This means that the U.S. military doesn't accomplish anything, which may or may not be the case. What this means, there's a great line by Robin Morgan. She says that anywhere in the world, any woman can be walking alone late at night. And if she hears footsteps behind her, she has reason to be afraid. Systematic violence by men against women has fundamentally changed the behavior of 51% of the human population. It is not true that violence is not effective. The truth is that violence is dreadfully effective. That's why they use it. A few years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine. She's a longtime activist. She was sobbing. She said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. I said, yeah, I'll do that. She said, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, unless it stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, didn't it? I said, yeah, it is, unless it stopped. She said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I thought it was the best thing I could say is because about, 16, 17 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse where I was bursting into sobs several times a week at the death of Kootenai sturgeon, Selkirk caribou, bull trout. A lot of my friends were saying, my activist friends were saying, Derek, take some time off. The problem is to be there when you come back. You're getting burned out. And I knew that wasn't right. I knew that if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what do tears mean? I knew I just had to keep pushing. And one day I called up this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong. She's an Okanagan Indian, a writer and activist. I was sobbing. And I said, this work's killing me. It's breaking my heart. And I said, yeah, it'll do that. I said, dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. I said, it has death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is unless it stopped. I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said the best thing she could possibly say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing she could say is because it normalized my despair. It let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. It let me know that sorrow is just sorrow, and pain is just pain. And it's not so much the sorrow or the pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. It let me know that I could feel all those things and it wouldn't kill me. There's this idea that if you acknowledge how bad things are, you have to go around being miserable all the time. But I'm a complex enough being that I can hold in my heart the understanding that we're really fucked. And that life's really good. And that we are so fucked. And that life is just so good. And we're fucked. And that life's really good. And I got this note from this woman one time asking, how does your anger at the dominant culture affect your sex life? And I was so tempted to write back, that's a question to which you will never know the answer. But I realized that that question is based on the idea that anger is a shotgun. And the truth is, surprisingly enough, that I'm angry at the things that make me angry, and I'm not angry at the things that don't make me angry. I'm not generally an angry person. I'm angry at the corporations that are destroying democracy and killing the planet. Gosh, who'd think it? And I am full of rage and hate and sorrow. And joy and love and happiness and contentment and discontent. We're allowed to feel more than one thing at a time, you know? And so a great thing happened that day that I realized that I didn't have to fight those feelings. I could feel them and it wouldn't kill me. But an even better thing happened, which is I realized I could feel all those things and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is that once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing, and you can still dance, and you can still make love, and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. There's a great poem by the Zen poet Bunan, "Die while you're alive and be absolutely dead, then do whatever you want. It's all good." One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Do you want to get an ID card, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. But I'll tell you something very important, which is the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Keep that in mind over the next 10 to 15 years. Zygmunt Bauman wrote that rational people go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. I've modernized that, and I would say that rational people go quietly, meekly to the end of the world if only you allow them to believe that buying compact fluorescence will save the day. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. What are the false hopes that keep you tied to the system? Does anybody think that Plum Creek will stop deforesting because we ask nicely? Does anybody think that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we ask nicely? Does anybody think that just because we have a Democrat in the White House, things are going to be okay? What are the false hopes you have, and how can you eradicate them? But the problem isn't just false hope, but it's hope itself. Several years ago, I was doing a talk, and I was gleefully bashing hope, and some of the audience shouted out, "What's your definition of hope?" I was like, "Oh my God, I've been bashing for years. I have no idea what I'm talking about." So I asked them, "What's your definition of hope?" And they gave me an answer, which is, "Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency." Hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. That's how we use it in everyday language. I know men are supposed to be afraid of commitment, but I'm going to commit to you right here, right now in public, that I'm going to eat something later tonight. On the other hand, when I get on a plane tomorrow, I hope it doesn't crash, because once it's in the air, I have no agency. It's like someone asked me, "Are you telling me that I shouldn't hope that my brother survives cancer?" And I say, "No, of course you can hope your brother survives cancer. What you can't do is stand there with car keys in your hand and say, 'I hope you make it to the hospital.'" And this is, once again, how we use it in everyday language. Is there anybody in here who has a child or grandchild who's like 8 or 9 or 10? Okay, child, grandchild? Grandchild? So if you said to your grandchild, "Would you please clean your room?" and the grandchild said back to you, "I hope it gets clean," what would be your response? Yeah, exactly. You know, my mom's response would have been, "Yeah, you better hope it gets clean." And so when people say that they hope that global warming doesn't kill the oceans or that it doesn't kill the planet, what they're saying is that they have no agency. Or when people say, "I hope that coho salmon survive," what they're saying is they have no agency. Well, I'll tell you this. I don't hope that global warming does not kill the planet. And I don't hope that coho salmon survive, because I will do whatever it takes to make sure that the dominant culture doesn't kill the planet and that it doesn't drive coho salmon extinct. If coho salmon don't like how they're being treated and they want to go away, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But if they don't want to go extinct, I will not allow the dominant culture drive them extinct. I do not hope that coho salmon survive. It is customary, when speaking of the apocalypse, to end on a happy note. And I can't do that, but I'll do the best I can. I want to read two short things. one of which is the most beautiful thing I've ever written, and I didn't actually write it. It was written by a stream near my house, by which I don't mean I wrote it by the stream. What I mean is the stream wrote it. And I've been trying for about a week before that to write about what it would be like to be a river. And I finally realized how stupid that is when I live right next to a stream, because that'd be like me writing about what it's like to be a woman when I can ask you. So I went down to the stream and I said, "What's it like to be you?" And I realized, first off, that that's the most important question anybody can ask anyone in any relationship. What's it like to be you? And also, the stream had been waiting so long for a human to ask that question of it. It gave me the answer just like that. And I went running back to the house as fast as I could to write down what it said. As I'm running through the forest is like, "Hello, what's it like to be me?" So I wrote down what they said. "Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pox and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You're the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You're the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You're the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall who turns water to air and air to water. You're the mist who settles on the soil. You're the plants who drink the mist, and you're the sun who warms and feeds them. You're the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river, who's all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees, the meadows you flood and feed and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects, who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who, with their own bodies, again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You've carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever and as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who becomes owls, who becomes slugs, who becomes shrews, who becomes soil. You're the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks through the trees and the trees who speak through the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold, and you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die. And the last thing I want to mention is a tradition of the Cheyenne dog soldiers called the picket, pin, and stake. Before a battle, a few of the bravest Cheyenne dog soldiers would be chosen to wear sashes of tan skins called dog ropes. Attached to each dog rope was a picket pin, normally used to tether horses. During battle, the pin would be driven into the ground as a mark of resolve. Once the pin was driven, The dog soldier would remain staked to that piece of ground, even to his death. Retreat was no longer an option. The pin could only be removed when everyone was again safe, or when another dog soldier relieved them of his duty. It is time. I've driven my picket pin. I'm staked out and willing to give in no more. Where will you drive your own picket stake? Where will you choose to make your stand? Give me a threshold, a specific point at which you finally stop running, at which you finally fight back. Stand with me. Stand and fight. I am one, we would be two. Two more might join and we would be four. When four more join, we will be eight. It will be eight people fighting whom others will join. And then more people and more. Stand and fight. The questions before each of us now are, what are your gifts and how can you use them in the service of your land base? What can you do? What does your land base most need from you? How can you achieve it? What do you want to do? And right now, perhaps most important of all, what are you willing to do? People ask me all the time, so Derek, what do you want us to do with all this information? What do you want us to do with all this analysis? And I always say, I want you not to listen to me because I don't live here and I don't know how to live sustainably. I'm doing a drive-by. I'm here today and I'm gone tomorrow. If you want to know what to do, then what you should do is ask the Winooski. Ask the Winooski River. Because if you ask it, it will tell you how to live, and it will tell you what it needs. And then really the only question is, are you willing to do it? So thank you very much. Okay, one more thing before we either do Q&A or whatever it is we're going to do, which is also I would like to thank Mike over there for security. So thank you, Mike. What time is it?
9:30.
Okay, how about if we let people go who want to go, and then people want to stay, we do like a half hour? Is that okay with you?
Okay. All right, so anybody who wants to stay for any Q&A, come up to the front, and other people, I know it's late, you've got other things to do, theses to write, exams, parties to go to, and the earth to celebrate. But if you want to do some Q&A, come on up and we'll just take it up in a minute here.
I'm much better with one, you know, which I do now, but those big glasses, they're big platforms like this, so I don't know if we can really regroup the energy or not. Fantastic. That's really, really
So we try to regroup a little bit. Whoever wants to stay, let us know by coming up and grabbing a seat. And then we'll be able to tell who does have questions. And of course, there are books outside. If you want to read some of Derek's books, please take a look. Okay, we're ready for some questions here. There's a lot of really pretty wild material. So we'll need everybody to quiet down a little bit so we can actually hear our questioners. Because I don't know if we have a portable, maybe I can do this, portable mic. That might work.
And so since this is a man, let's have a woman be the next one.
For starters, why not the peaceful dissolution of the American empire with tiny Vermont leading the way?
Sure. I think that that is part of it, and I think it's also possible that insofar as it being peaceful, I think that those who run the federal government may actually have something to say about it as well. See, it's pretty interesting, too, that somebody once asked John Stockwell, who was a former CIA agent who came out against the agency, they asked him, if everything you say is true, why haven't you been killed yet? And his answer was really straightforward and kind of scary, which is because they're winning. And people ask me all the time, have I suffered state repression because of my work? And I always say the same thing is no, because they're winning. But as things become increasingly fascist, the intellectuals are always the first to go. And so as things become more openly fascist, I'm thinking, I mean, at that point, I'm dead. Of course, so is everybody else who... So is everybody else who does anything, you know? But I've been thinking a lot about the Soviet Union, and I think it's also possible that, that's sort of one route that this country could go, and the far right and the sort of militants of the far right scares the hell out of me these days, you know, because it seems very clearly like 1920s Germany, and just very, very brown shirtish. And, that's pretty predictable, actually, that when people's entitlement is threatened through whatever means, including ecological collapse, that those people will oftentimes, the contempt that they felt for those they perceive as inferior turns into outright hatred. And that's really predictable, and it's very scary. So that's one route I see this country going, is outright fascism, in which case I'll see you in the gulags for about a week before we get shot. And another possibility, though, that I've been thinking about more and more, is it's really possible that the United States could just end up dissolving through, like, the Soviet Union did, where they just can't deliver the mail anymore. Yeah, well, great. And, see, here's another important thing, is that I have a friend who does, I already said this to a class earlier today, I have a friend who the reason he does environmental activism is because he says as things have become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is that if grizzly bears are still around in 20 years, they may be still around in 100, but if they're gone in 20, they're gone forever. And so we can't control what happens as things become increasingly chaotic. So one of the things that we need to do is we need to be having these conversations now. People ask me all the time, so do you advocate violence? And I always say, no, I don't advocate violence. I don't advocate nonviolence. I advocate putting everything on the table and let's talk about it. We need to have those conversations now. And we need to be setting up those alternative institutions now, the groovy eco-villages, which I think are useless in terms of resistance, capital R resistance, but they're absolutely necessary in terms of forming a culture of resistance. And we need to put that in place now. And another thing I talk about, I know this isn't really what you asked, but another thing, and I talked about this afternoon, I talk about it because I think it's so important, is if you want to know what happens when civic society collapses under a patriarchy, look at the Democratic Republic of Congo. And what I mean by that is there are mass organized rapes going on there. And there are mass rapes in the United States, but the rate has gone up. When civic society collapses, that's one of the things that happens. So what we need to do, one of the things we need to do to prepare for that, because whether we do anything or not, civic society is going to collapse through peak oil, everything else. And one of the things we need to do is we need to prepare for that possibility among many others. And I really love Andrea Dworkin's quote about my prayer for women of the 21st century is this, harden your hearts and learn to kill. And what women need to do is to need to learn self-defense. And the time to do that is not when somebody breaks in your house. The time to do that is now. And what men need to do is men need to make our allegiance to women absolute. And we need to do that now. We have to establish zero tolerance policies for violence against women. And consent is sexy. Ask, says a sign back. That was not me. That was him. Him, even. That's great. By the way, I don't, it's so funny. I saw this just recently. You've probably already seen this. You know all those signs where they say, you know, there's things women should do if they're afraid of being raped? Like if you're walking across campus, carry a whistle, and all these things you can do to keep from being raped. I saw a version for men. Have you seen this? It's great. It's like, if you feel like you might rape someone, don't do it. If you see a woman walking alone through an alley, don't rape her. If you see a woman stop by the side of the road and her car is stuck, it's okay to give her help with her car, don't rape her. It's great, which puts it back where it was supposed to be. Anyway, so I think, as I said earlier, you know, only 2% of the IRA picked up weapons. You know, there's tremendous amounts of social work that need to be done that surround resistance. And so I think that, yes, we need, I think that looking for the peaceful secession of Vermont is a great thing. And I think at the same time, we need to be prepared for, we also need to be prepared for the possibility of a physical response by those in power. And so that has to include training, which includes emotional training. Oops, emotional. No, emotional, mental. How is that? That's good. Good deconstruction there. We have to have emotional and mental training and physical training for self. It's like at the Oka crisis with the Mohawks standing off the RCMP. For the first few days, it was absolutely crazy, and they did some really stupid things, in part because they had no one there with any military training. And then when some Mohawks showed up who had military training, and some elders showed up, because that's the thing, too. You know, young people are really impetuous, they're really brave, and then also sometimes they're kind of stupid. And they need elders around to tell them. At the Oka crisis, you can see, like, there's some young warriors are shooting at the RCMP, and some of the grandmothers ride down in golf carts and say, you know, now is not the time to do that. There's wisdom that sometimes comes from being older. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. We all need to prepare these communities before whatever happens, happens. Did you have?
Oh, okay. I was actually in the class that you spoke in earlier today, and one thing that a kind of common theme that I've noticed is you keep mentioning working with Native Americans and other indigenous peoples, and I was just curious to your involvement and even your reasoning.
What was the word after involvement?
Reasoning.
Oh, reasoning?
Yeah, why?
Well, the reasoning is pretty straightforward in that it's their land. And any talk of sustainability must begin from that understanding that I can't speak for you because I don't know what I don't know whether you're white or indigenous, but for myself, but okay. So any work that I do on sustainability has to begin absolutely from the understanding that I'm living on stolen land and proceed from there. And it gets pretty interesting sometimes because I was talking, I mentioned my Dakota friend Waz earlier today. I was talking to her about this and we're both laughing pretty hard because where I live on Talawa land, and right now the Talawa, actually for the last couple of years, they've been trying to put in a world-class golf course on endangered Western Lily land. And a lot of people have asked me to somehow get involved, and it's like, that is so, I am not even walking into that minefield. because on one hand, they've lived there, I mean, the Talawa have been there forever, but on the other hand, like I was asking my friend Waz about this, I asked, is there a single tribal council in North America that you trust even remotely? And she's laughing, you know, no, of course not. And so, once again, I'm just going to stay out of that because there's other battles I can fight long before that one. Anyway, it has to start with that. That's part of the reasoning. And I'm sorry, I don't remember if I talked about this today or if I talked about this 2 days ago in Idaho, but somebody asked me, I think this was 2 days ago, somebody asked me, how do we become allies with indigenous people? Was that today? Oh, okay. Well, that was today then. And I just said, you know, I do my work, and if they want to then talk to me about it, that's fine. And if they don't, you know, I'm just doing my work and making myself open. Extent. I had a really interesting conversation. I did a talk at an Indian university in Thunder Bay, and beforehand we had a dinner, and there was me and one white teacher from the school, and then a bunch of Indian college students. And this one Indian college student was really excited and very militant, and he started asking me about resistance. And the white teacher said, she was making a joke, but she said, if you tell him it's okay to fight back, I'm going to kill you. And so we just chatted a bit. And then afterwards, I took him aside, and I said, okay, here is what I think is the only thing that I can say to you as a white person, which is, it is none of my business as a white member of an oppressor class to tell you how you can and cannot resist. And that is up to you. And we can talk, but I don't have your experience. And there's two more things I want to say about this I think are really important. One of them is that I've thought about this a lot, and this is true for, I think this is generically true for any oppressor and oppressed classes, that it is not your job to differentiate me from other men. It is my job to differentiate myself from other members of the oppressor class. And it is not your job as an indigenous person to differentiate me from other white people. It is my job to differentiate myself. It is always the oppressor classes, the members of the oppressor class. It is up to us individually to differentiate ourselves. It's not your responsibility. So if you want to, like, go kill all whites, it's not my fault. I mean, I'm sorry, it's not your fault if you kill me among them. And I thought of this first day because I was fantasizing years ago about, okay, what would happen if I went to Iraq and I said, hey, I'm here to help. And, you know, I might get killed within a day. And it wouldn't be their fault because I'm just another American. Which, by the way, I don't think that would happen, though, because Dar Jamail went over and he was really welcomed as a journalist who wanted to tell their story. And they kept saying, hey, you want a gun? You want a gun? It's like, I think I'll stick with a pen. That's one thing I want to say. Oh, the other thing I think is really important to say is I did a talk in Portland last fall, and this one woman stood up and she was crying, and she said, you know, I want the dams to come down, but I don't want to do it because I'm really scared. And I said, you know, I'm scared too, and we're all scared. And what's really important, though, is that we as white people, not yet again put the indigenous people on the front line, and that we not put poor people and people of color on the front line. And we've been doing that for a long time. And it's absolutely crucial that we not leave this up to the Mohawks to fight and up to the Salish to fight, you know, or whomever. That we as white people, me as white people, because you're... Anyway, That's also really crucial, is that we can't. It was so interesting because Waz and two of her friends were there, were Indians, and when I said the thing about we can't continue to put indigenous people on the front line, the place was like 600 people, and those three burst into applause. Everybody else is just, anyway, but that's pretty interesting. So reasons, how, and extent, I don't know, it's pretty interesting because my work is mainly to write, and I know, and it makes me really happy that my book is used, Endgame is used in indigenous leadership classes at least one Indian university. So that makes me happy. I'm sorry?
Hello, Derek.
Hey.
My name is Jason, and I just want to say it really means so much to me that you've come to our school today.
Well, thank you.
And I've heard that the frequency of rape in the United States has been reported to be as much as 20 times greater than its frequency in other South American or European countries in the world. And I just wanted to pose the question, do you think that this could possibly be related to the fact that so often in the United States, when a baby boy is born, their first experience of their life is a strange crossing over of sex and violence where some person grabs their genitals and cuts out all of the most sensual or sensitive parts of it and just permanently destroys their private and personal internal realm that they have there. And if you think this might have something, this insane practice might have something to do with the strange overlapping of sexuality and violence that I see all around me today.
And thank you for that question too. And I think it probably could, but I don't think it's really necessary when you have, you know, the Bible is just full of stories. And when we have, I think that could very well, like, mess some people up pretty severely. I think, in addition, we have what do the movies, On the Waterfront, Straw Dogs, Dr. Zhivago, all have in common, and a bunch of other movies, what they all have in common is they all have the standard pornographic rape fantasy as one of the scenes. V for Vendetta, where a man abuses a woman, and then she says she loves him. Or like in Dr. Zhivago, Evgrav is raping Lara, and Lara pushes him away, and by the end of the scene, she's pulling him close. Or V for Vendetta really pisses me off that he kidnaps her, he tortures her, and holds her in isolation, and what's the first goddamn thing she says? It's like, I love you. It's like, fuck that. She should pick up a gun and shoot him in the head. And what that's doing is that's normalizing, that's teaching men that when women say no, they don't really mean no. And it's teaching women, maybe also, that when you say no, it doesn't really mean no. But I'm mainly interested in actually what it's teaching the men. And so my point is that there are, that's why I make the joke early on about, not joke, but when I make the comment about, when it's not a joke at all, I don't know why I said that. When I make the comment about if when you look at women you perceive orifices, then that's, you're going to treat them one way. And honestly, that's how systematically, in many ways, men are taught, you know, through advertising. I love the book The Age of Sex Crime by Jane Caputi. Anybody read that? Great book. Did you like it? I love that book. One of the things that she does in there is she says she puts together serial sex crime, where oftentimes women are mutilated, including genitally and on their breasts, and unnecessary surgeries on women's breasts and on their, like, unnecessary hysterectomies and unnecessary surgeries on their breasts, and then also the way that women are cut up to be used in advertising. You know, women's body parts are used in advertising. So I think, once again, that certainly circumcision, I mean, if I were, you know, Commander Derek Jensen in charge of all possible surgeries on genitalia, you know, I would say yes to vasectomies and no to circumcision. But I think in addition, we have, you know, double your pleasure, double your fun. You know, what the hell do a couple of twins with large breasts have to do with gum? So I think there's an entire culture that's pushing us that way. But yes, there may certainly be a mechanical or a very early childhood component that I'm not aware of. How about a woman again?
Hi, Derek. My name's Alyssa.
Hey.
I got back from Haiti about 2 weeks ago, and I was speaking to some of my friends today, and I'm curious what advice you might give for Haiti's urban poor right now. I mean, the Haitians are, there's the indigenous culture in Haiti is almost non-existent. The people there are, you know, slaves from Africa that revolted against the French, and it's the most impoverished country in the Western Hemisphere. But they have an incredibly resilient and beautiful cultural identity. It's totally unique. Any advice for the urban poor there in the wake of the earthquake? And two, what would you do with $5 billion of international aid?
Okay, the first question, what would I say? Are you talking about what would I say to activists in Haiti or what would I say to Haitians? One thing I would say is don't trust the United States, but I don't have to tell you that. And because I've also seen what some of the aid packages consist of in terms of sweatshops, and I don't know. I'm just gonna ramble for a second because I don't have an answer. But the first thing that I thought of is that a couple times when I've been on tour, I've been picked up by Haitian taxi drivers, and both times. And I found this remarkable. It happened twice. Both times, they expressed extreme pride in Haiti's history of resistance. And, one of the very few, we could say almost entirely successful slave revolts. And so, actually, if I were to talk to Haitians, the first thing I'd want to do is, hey, you know, tell me how you did it. What? Unfortunately, the corporations are doing that here, and it ain't working. What I would want to talk with them about is not just technically how did you do it. I've actually, you know, I mentioned early on that the book I just finished was kind of about dreams, and it's really about, I don't believe dreams are psychoanalytic. I think that they come from other places. And traditional, you know, I've never heard of an indigenous culture that's atheistic, or that does not believe in other sides at all. And so I really go into all the stuff with other sides, and one of the things I was exploring was the, you know, however you want to say it, voodoo or voodan, the relationship between voodan and resistance through that time period. And then in addition, and one of the reasons I got into that in the first place is because, with every one of my books, I pretty much escalated the rhetoric as to what I think about members of this culture, that in A Language All in Words, well, they're... I think the entire culture is suffering from complex post-traumatic stress disorder. In Culture Make-Believe, I call some of the leaders nasty-ass motherfuckers. And then Endgame, I think that most members of this culture are sociopathological. See the escalation here? And then in the Dreams book, I asked for a dream from some frogs about what it's like to be a frog at this point. And basically, it was to be under constant assault from a bunch of flesh-eating zombies. And this actually makes more sense to me than anything else I've ever written, in that I really think that a lot of members of the dominant culture have been, they're not even human anymore. And a lot of indigenous people said the same thing. They're flesh-eating zombies. And so in light of that, I started looking at the history of zombification. And it's really interesting to, if you look, and I'm sure you know this better than I, but if you look, or when I looked, at a lot of the Haitian stories of zombification in the first place, it's not the zombies you're afraid of. It's that someone will turn you into a zombie. And I was reading some very interesting analyses of zombification as the process of colonialism and of slavery, of enslavement, and of capitalism. That basically, that's what capitalism does, is turn you from a free agent into a working zombie, and with one who has no will. And that was the tremendous fear. And nowadays, by now, through, you know, George Romero and through all the, you know, Left 4 Dead computer game, which is actually pretty good, the zombies are no longer controlled by zombie masters, and the fear is not that you'll be zombified yourself, but the fear is that you'll be consumed by these flesh-eating zombies. And I was reading this analysis, it's pretty damn cool, about how that follows sort of the trajectory of colonization, in that if you're not fully colonized, then you see a source. The zombie master is the source of the zombification. But once the zombies reach a certain critical mass, whether we're talking metaphorically or really, it doesn't matter, they reach a certain mass, suddenly the source disappears, and what there is there's this voracious mass of zombies who are going to eat your brain, which we've sure gone a hell of a long way from your question. But one of the reasons I would hesitate to say anything to the Haitians would be the same as I said to the woman here about how I don't know their experience. And so I would be very hesitant to give them any advice except for don't trust the United States. And so far as what I would do with $5 million, For Haiti? You know, I hate to say this, and this is going to get me doubly kicked out of the Anarchy Club, but, you know, probably what I would do is, we do live within a capitalist system, which is just wretched and horrible, but I might try the microloan thing or something, you know? I don't know, because once again, I hate the capitalist system, I hate the idea of making money, but right now within this system, with people having been removed from with the land, with there being more people on the land and more people on the land can support, with especially Haiti being absolutely devastated, you know, it's like I would try to help people become independent of the U.S. economy, and to help them become food self-sufficient, food, clothing, and shelter self-sufficient. Because as soon as they're that, well, then of course the United States will invade again and make it so they aren't. But that gives them tremendous power. It's like, I mentioned this earlier today, that years ago I interviewed a member of the Tupac Amaristas, the MRTA, and I said, what do you want for the people of Peru? And it was a rebel group in Peru. And the guy said, we want to be able to grow and distribute our own food. We already know how to do so. We already know how to do that. We merely need to be allowed to do so. And that's pretty much the entire struggle right there across the world. And so what I would do with the 5 million is I would try to get a way that they could be food self-sufficient, that at least some community could be food self-sufficient. Wait, we have, how many people have their hands raised? 12? She seems really eager. Yeah, you. Yes. Yeah, you. Hey. There's a lot of questions there. And one of them, I think, and okay, I say this as somebody who's not a parent and who never really wanted to be a parent, so, I mean, I like having my nieces around. Like, when I lived near them, it was great to have them come over, and then as soon as they got tired, I would send them home. So, you know, I don't really know kids. So everything I'm saying is just kind of bullshit. But having said that, of course, since I'm a male, I'm going to soldier on. And in fact, I will tell you what you should do. It seems to me, I'm just making this up off the top of my head, it seems to me But one of the important things to do with children is to attempt to help them not to lose their sense of animism and to struggle. Oh, thank you. So to struggle against everything the culture tells them about, you know, when it, like, I'm sure you noticed during the talks, I'm so glad that nobody laughed when a couple times I said, the tree said. And when I say that, I'm not speaking metaphorically. I mean, that's the tree. I used to think that a lot of times that walking was good for me to help me write, that I would write, but then I realized that there are actually certain trees that if I walk by them, ideas will come more readily than others, than other places. So I'm thinking like the whole forest is saying, look, you talk to him. I don't want to talk to him. And so whatever you can do to help children maintain that. And then in addition, I remember probably, 27 years ago, I was riding with my niece. My niece was probably 6 or 7, and she was going to a soccer game. And I went along for some reason I will probably never understand. And so I'm in the back of a station wagon with like 3 or 4 little girls, and then there's two mothers up in front. And we go past this hay field, and one of the little girls says to her mother, what is that machine out in the field? And her mother blew her off, just like, I don't know, dear, and then went back to her conversation. And I was contrasting that with what my mom did to me when I was a kid, and what I've seen my mom do to my nephews and nieces. I keep saying two, it must be a Freudian slip. Doing four, my nephews and nieces, all the time, which is, if I would have said that to my mom, what's that there? My mom would have said, so what sort of field is that? It's a hay field. Well, if you were going to have a machine in a hay field, what do you think, what sort of machine would you have there? Would you have a car washing machine? Would you have a hose rolling machine? Would you have a cannon? It's like, no, I'd probably have a hay cutting machine. It's like, oh, God, you're so smart. And, you know, not patronizing at all, but really instilling critical thinking. And then, or practicing critical thinking. And then another thing that, and once again, I haven't done any of this, because I don't, but another thing my mom did I think was really great was starting in third grade, I never had a bedtime. I could stay up as late as I wanted with one or two caveats or rules, which is A, I am going to go to school, and B, I am not going to whine. So if I couldn't be like running around, you know, I could stay up reading until 3 o'clock in the morning if I wanted, but I am going to be up at 7 o'clock, and I'm going to be at the school bus at 7:30, and she's not going to hear one word of complaint. If she hears one word of complaint, the deal's off. And I really like that because it was teaching me accountability and teaching me, rules, and also that it's okay to not have structure as long as we have structure around not having structure. And insofar as the educational system, that's a really hard one too, because on one level, you know, as I've written in Walking on Water, one of the reasons school takes so long is because children don't give up their wills easily, and it takes that long to break their will sufficiently for a life of painful employment. But on the other hand, I've had a lot of people write to me and say, I'm a freshman in college and I want to quit and go live out in the forest. Were you in the class when I mentioned this earlier? Okay, yeah. And what I always say to them is I'm a big believer in keeping your options open. And if you finish college, you're going to have more options than if you don't. And one of the smartest things my mom said to me was when I was a junior in college, I desperately wanted to quit. And my mom said, okay, great. Would you rather go the rest of your life saying you have 3 years toward a degree in physics, or go the rest of your life saying you have a degree in physics? Which I found very, very, very compelling. And also, and I mentioned this in the class earlier, that I spent a lot of my 20s really, really, really poor. And there's a huge difference between, because I wanted to write, and writers don't make any money, and there's a huge difference between being really, really, really poor, and at any moment I can pick up a telephone and I can call some employment agency and I can get a job working in physics for $35,000 a year in 1983, and being able to pick up a phone and calling Walmart and asking if they have an application. So my point is that it's really, once again, within the capitalist system, it's really a double bind, because you do want children to have the option, when they grow up, to have options of, you know, working or not working, you know, entering the wage economy or not entering the wage economy. And one of the ways to do that is to go through the vocational training that is school. So shit, I don't know. I mean, it's I'm sorry? Maybe look at school. You know, one of the things my mom did too is she looked at school as a place for me to socialize. And so I went to school basically to play, and then at home, I mean, I learned math not from school. I learned math from baseball. You know, finding pitchers' ERA. I was able to do that before I went to school. ERA was the hardest. It was way harder than batting average. And I learned how to read. You know, my mom taught me how to read very young. And then school was all just basically tedium with recesses in between. But I made a lot of friends there. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Okay. Well, let's see. How about, does anybody have like a one-sentence question that I can answer in one sentence that's like, we're ready to storm the Bastille? The Bastille? And we'll all sing the Internationale. Well, I don't really agree that the Nazi movement had its basis in deep ecology. I've actually written in Culture Make Believe how it has its roots in modernity and automation and the utilitarian worldview. And there is a tradition. It's not a one sentence answer either. There is a tradition in Germany that actually was pretty harmful. It's called the Wandervogel. The wandering youth. And they were sort of the equivalent of hippies as a youth culture based on fitness and everything else, and wandering around pretending to be peasants without actually talking to real peasants, which I think is part of your point. That they really idealized the peasants but never actually spoke to any. And they were militantly non-political. And that allowed that energy to be taken to whatever ends. And actually, we deal with this in the book I'm working on right now. But the point is, I think I agree with... I think that members of an oppressor class, as I said earlier, we do have a responsibility to consult with and to, when appropriate, defer to members of oppressed classes. And we also... especially have a responsibility to use our privilege to undercut its very basis. I've had people say to me before that, you know, it was pretty interesting. After I wrote Culture Make Believe, there was this African-American guy came to the talk, and he said afterwards, you know, I could have written the same book and it wouldn't have gotten published. He was really pissed off. He was trying to pick a fight. I could have written the same book and it wouldn't have got published. You got this published because you're white. I was like, you know what? Probably being white really helped. He said, well, wait a minute. You got this published because you're white. And I said, you know what? Probably being white really helped. And it is my responsibility to use the authority that comes with being a member of a privileged class, use the privilege that comes with being a member of a privileged class to undercut its basis everywhere. And I think that's actually a good note to end on. Well, thank you. So I'll sign books for like the next 10, 15 minutes or whatever, and then I got to go.